Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack.
And Sean Chapman.
We are here to talk about stuff this week on the show. Our primary topic is going to be an in-depth, spoiler-filled review of God of War 2018. Asterisk on the title.
Yes, we have both finished it now because we did a sort of overview gameplay kind of discussion last week on the podcast. Now it'll be full spoiler extravaganza. It'll be everything.
Yes. We still think it's a good game.
Yes, it's a really good game.
Yes, you should play it if you have a PS4. And if you don't have a PS4, I don't know. I don't know what to tell you. You're not convinced by now, I really don't know.
Yeah, there are some good games on it.
A couple.
Yeah. Especially then there'll be Spider-Man later this year.
I
think this is going to be a very good year to own a PS4.
Yes. We are also going to be talking a little bit of Donkey Kong Country, because I have been on a months-long trek to play every Donkey Kong Country game before the release of Donkey Kong Country Tropical Freeze on the Nintendo Switch, which I am now playing, and will be the subject of maybe a topic within a topic, where you are going to have to give me a game therapy session, because I did the thing where I couldn't beat a level and kept trying for 3 hours until 3 a.m, and I felt bad.
Yeah, I had a similar situation with something in God of War. I don't think something quite so extreme, but we'll unpack
we'll
our feelings here.
We'll work it out. Speaking of feelings, Sean, we were, I guess, going to do our next Doctor Who discussion this week.
I feel like if you re-listened to the last week's podcast, you said that we were going to record the Doctor Who podcast the following week.
I thought I said the following month, which gives me more leeway.
Okay, I interpreted that as we were going to do it the following week.
I'm not saying that's an unreasonable assumption.
Yeah, especially since we missed that 1 month of
April. I'm just saying I haven't thought about it.
Okay.
And so that's what happened. Because
I'm just saying I listened to it like 2 days before we were originally going to record the podcast about the Chimes of Midnight. And it has now been almost a month since then. And so it's like I'm really going to have to re-listen to the whole thing again.
I know. Things get pushed back. I'm sorry. I'm going on a car trip this week. Maybe I'll listen to it then.
There you go. That'd be good.
That'd be a good time to do
good
it.
Time.
In any case, there will be another Doctor Who thing at some point.
Yes, it would be bad for us to flake out on the last episode of, like, that cycle.
It really would be. Again, fitting if it's the Eighth Doctor because of everything that happened to the poor guy. But,
yeah,
you know,
but we can only make that joke so many times.
We can. So, we will get to it at some point. Today, though, got a loose episode. I don't have any news on the outline. There was a new Red Dead trailer that showed us nothing we didn't already know, so I'm like, whatever.
Yeah, it felt like that should have been the trailer before the last trailer, because I feel like the last trailer showed us more than this trailer did.
It
still wasn't much.
I don't know. I cannot. There's been three so far, I think. I can't distinguish. They're all the exact same thing. We know literally zero about that game. One day, maybe. I'm sure it will be fine. But we'll see.
Yeah,
I'm not.
This is not unusual for Rockstar. I feel like this is what they always do. And then, like a month or two before the game actually comes out, they'll do their weird thing they do. Where, like, I remember very strongly, GTA 5 had that trailer where it's like just this lady talking about, like, here's Grand Theft Auto 5, and here's all the stuff you do. It was like a 5-minute trailer of just this lady talking to you. It's like they completely eschewed any sense of bigging it an in-world trailer. I bet we will get something like that in, like, August.
Sure. I'm less annoyed at Rockstar, though. I'm more annoyed at the internet. Like, I don't want to talk about it until there's something to talk about. There's literally nothing to talk about with this game. And so it's like, just cut the SEO bullshit.
No, Jonathan, there's one thing to talk about with that trailer. There's a young John Marston.
Sure.
Which is something that we basically mostly, like, here's what we knew before that trailer. Young John Marston is probably going to be in this game based on everything we know about it. This is what we now know. He's definitely in that game.
Okay. I don't care that much.
Yeah.
I like Red Dead 1 a lot.
Yeah.
But we'll see. Anyway, so that happened. I don't think anything else really of note in the stupid news happened.
Yes, in the stupid news.
The other news, oh my God.
It's a never-ending maelstrom of utter shit.
Yeah, but that's not the kind of podcast this is. That's our spin-off podcast, an utter maelstrom of crazy shit.
Yeah.
Or an endless whatever you said.
Never-ending maelstrom.
Never-ending maelstrom of utter shit, yes. I think that's our other podcast. But for now, Sean, let's talk some stuff.
Okay, yeah.
I'm going to go with one stuff first.
Okay.
I've still been watching Yu-Gi-Oh! Duel
Congratulations,
Monsters in Japanese. I'm in the 70s now. The episodes, not Yu-Gi-Oh! From the 70s. That'd be pretty great.
It's a whole arc where it flashes back to the 70s when Yugi's grandpa was young and hip and on the duel monster scene.
I think that would be great. I mean, they've done like 8 spinoffs now. They're probably running out of ideas. That would be one.
Just Yugi's grandpa fucking dropping acid and playing Duel Monsters at like an orgy in the 70s.
So, Sean,
so good.
Obviously, they don't have the advanced holograms back then.
Right, yeah.
So they just drop acid before they play Duel Monsters, and all the monsters are acid fantasies.
Yeah, man. Yeah, it's a way cooler looking Blue Eyes White Dragon.
Exactly. No, but I'm in the 70s of the episodes. As listeners will remember, I've always wanted to watch the show in Japanese. Crunchyroll finally has it. Not quite the whole thing yet, but they're getting there. They've got most of the good stuff, and so I'm watching through it. Great! I love this show so much. I love how ridiculous it is sometimes. I am deep now into the series of duels that basically feel like they are scenarios from Saw movies, right, but with card games.
Yeah.
Like, and this is the other thing is that, you know, the Four Kids dub here in the States would try to soften all of that. And when you watch the actual show and, like, how little they actually changed, it's fucking hilarious what they asked us to believe. Mm-hmm. Like, there's the one where he duels the evil magician. Yugi duels the evil magician Pandora. And they both use the black magician card and all that. And anyway, that's the one where they have the buzzsaws at their legs.
Yeah.
And every time they lose life points, the buzzsaw comes closer. And it's going to, you know, cut off their legs if they lose the duel. And I remember, and that's just what it is. Because in that season of Yu-Gi-Oh!, the villain Merrick's whole plan is he just wants to kill Yugi. Like, that's a thing they, like, really obfuscated in the dub. But, like, that is literally, he just wants to murder this kid because he has the soul of this pharaoh he hates inside him. Which is much more direct as a motivation goes than whatever the hell it was in the dub.
You know, maybe he should also look into, like, the black market and, like, getting a pistol or something. Might be slightly more effective.
It's Japan. They have really tight gun control. His best plan is to do a really Rube Goldbergian Duel Monsters tournament, and that's how he kills the kid.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. I mean, that is basically, having played a couple of the Yakuza games, that's basically how it goes in the Yakuza. It's like, they can't, like, that's the only way to do a hit on somebody is to challenge them to a, like, ridiculous game that will cost you your life in some absurd Rube Goldbergian manner at the end.
But I love, like, in the Four Kids dub of that one with the buzzsaws, all they did is they put a blue filter over the saws so they're, like, blue buzzsaws, and they said, when the buzzsaw hits you, you go to the Shadow Realm, which is a complete invention of the dub for.
Yeah.
It's just a code word. Whenever they say Shadow Realm, the actual scenario is the person gets murdered.
Yeah. My favorite versions of those are like it was really prominent on a Dragon Ball Z Game Boy game, Legend of the Super Warriors or whatever the fuck the game the title was, where they replaced it just like they basically control F'd like die or kill. It was like defeat and be defeated. It's just like I'm going like, oh no, Krillin got defeated. It's like, no, he blew the fuck up.
Yep.
It's a bit more than defeated.
Or when they went to hell and in English they changed it to Hiffle.
Yes, the home for infinite losers.
It was
which
definitely.
Is still my is I still am fond of the home.
The best one ever, I think, in the original Dragon Ball Z dub is when Nappa is going after all the people in the helicopters and he's killing them, and they all are fucking dead. But in the dub, Master Roshi points up and says, "Don't worry, I can see their parachutes." And they didn't like animate any in. It's just we trust Master Roshi. He saw their parachutes.
Yeah, they're alive. It's okay.
Yeah, there's that one. There's the duel where Yugi and Kaiba have to duel together on the building, and the whole idea is if they drop to zero, a bomb will go off and they will fall through the skyscraper to the bottom. I'm particularly fond of that one. And then I'm in the middle of the duel now where Merrick has controlled Jinochi's mind.
Oh, no.
And they are both tied to an anchor at the pier.
Right.
And when they die,
when
they lose their life points, the anchor will drag them into the sea. It's like...
Which that's a dilemma because it's like Yugi will either has to live and kill his friend or lose the duel and die.
Yes, and that's my favorite one because it's also like there's the mental sadism of it.
Yeah.
Of like, it really does. It's a Saw game. And this is like years before the Saw movies were a thing is what's so funny. But like, that's so what it feels like.
Yeah, it's like the next one is just like he's fucking stuck tiny needles in every single card. So when you like draw a card, it just injects a little bit of poison into you. So it's like if you draw too many cards, you die.
But, I mean, it's the show is ridiculous, but honestly, like, when you watch in Japanese, it's so much more, I think, perfectly self-aware of its ridiculousness, because it is part of a genre. Like, it's such a shonen anime thing to do this of, like, there's this one thing everyone in the world is obsessed with, and if you buy into that, the rest of it makes sense.
Yeah.
You know? And so, like, yes, there's the logic issue of, what the hell has this one card game done to the planet Earth in the world of Yu-Gi-Oh!? Big thing. But if you buy into it, just like you're watching, you know, a soccer anime or something, and it's like people are... I know people love soccer on Earth, but not like they love soccer in anime.
Yeah.
Or tennis, or Hikaru no Go, where they're playing fucking Go or something like that.
It's the most important thing in anybody's life.
Yes.
And they are like super mega geniuses every single move.
It's one of my favorite subgenres of anime.
It's good.
It's good. And there's so many just good... Like, again, the author of Yu-Gi-Oh! Kazuki Takahashi was just so good at like writing the duels in like really fucking exciting, interesting ways where... You know, and there's a formula to it that is so like comforting and reassuring of every time they're going to be really the underdogs and something really bad is going to happen, but they're going to turn the tables. And when they do, and that music of them turning the tables plays, you get pumped every time.
Yeah.
And something we don't get like in TV much anymore, that kind of the formulaic television thing.
Yeah.
Because serialized television has mostly replaced that. But there is like, there's just a fun dopamine hit kind of thing to that. And actually, anime is good at mixing those two things so well.
Yeah.
The serialized and the formulaic. Anyway, I'm having a lot of fun. It's so fucking ridiculous. And I'm not even to the really crazy stuff of this season yet. Including, I'm at the point where you can tell they were catching up to the manga because they're having to insert random filler episodes. And I just watched the first recap clip show episode,
there
which...
You go.
Those in anime are bad, because they'll just show you, like, last week's episode again.
I mean, the most you can pray for is that it's so exactly a recap episode that you can skip it without missing anything. The worst is when it's, like, there's, like, this two-minute kernel in, like the middle of the episode that's, like, oh, this is, the like, some of the most essential plot information in this whole arc, and they just, like, set it right in the middle of all this bullshit, and it's, like... Well, fuck, I guess I'm watching 20 minutes of horseshit with 2 minutes of, like, a decent plot twist.
But because I'm in this phase where, like, you just start to just, like, Yu-Gi-Oh! Doesn't have a ton of filler, so, like, this little drip of, like, oh, it's, the faucet is turning a little more of, like, more filler. And that's because we're coming up on the infamous part of Yu-Gi-Oh! Where, in the middle of the Battle City arc, the longest arc in Yu-Gi-Oh!, they ran out of chapters, and so there's a 25-episode filler arc in the middle where they're on the fucking blimp to the finals, and it gets diverted. Into the video
this,
game world. I still think that is the most ridiculous example of filler I've ever seen, because most filler at least has the decency to wait until your story is over.
Yeah.
Yu-Gi-Oh! Like, no. Mid-story, we're going different villain. Kaiba's kind of the main character now for 25 episodes. Like, and I actually like those episodes from memory. I haven't seen them since I was a fucking kid, but like, filler is fascinating.
Yeah, it
comes in many shapes and sizes.
And it is one of my favorite topics in anime, and just like looking at how this happens, what it means, and it is still one of the more exciting things about what Game of Thrones has become to me. It's like, it is the Western filler, and it's like, what the fuck is happening to the
Game
world?
Of Thrones is very strange and weirdly anime-esque in what it's had to do.
Yeah.
But yeah. Anyway, alright, but that's my thing. I'm just having fun with that. What's
cool.
your thing?
Yeah, my thing, going from Yu-Gi-Oh! To literature. This is something this is something I don't usually talk about that much on the podcast, is all of my literature bullshit that I do. But because it's like sort of pursuant to the God of War discussion we're going to be having, I've decided to finally like actually like dive into Norse mythology as a like subject instead of just being this like thing I kind of know about around the edges, and I've read bits and pieces here and there. Like I've obviously read Beowulf a couple of times as a part of you have to read Beowulf at least once to be an English major, or they kill you. Like, it's something that happens, you know. It's one of those.
There's a buzzsaw coming at you until you finish the book.
Exactly, yeah. It's like, God, this fucking just bit with the fucking dragons just going on forever, but I gotta fucking read it. But yeah, so, and then obviously I've read, like, little bits of some, like, the Poetic Edda and all that kind of stuff, and I kind of understood, the history of Norse mythology and that kind of stuff, and maybe we'll talk about some of that when we talk about God of War. But I have never, like, really dug in and actually read the real stuff. And I'm not yet going, like, I've not yet decided I'm going to read the Poetic Edda and the Prose Edda, which are the two kind of, like, texts that we have that are, like, they're not actually primary sources, but they're the closest thing we have to primary sources on Norse mythology. I will probably end up getting there, but instead I have, and this is kind of, like, some recommendation stuff for the podcast and for you, Jonathan, if you're interested. I picked up two books that got here today as we're recording the podcast. So I have not had a lot of time to read them, but I've read kind of like the intros to both of them. One book is Norse Mythology by Neil Gaiman.
I have actually seen multiple people on Twitter buy this since God of War came out.
Yeah, I'm sure Neil Gaiman is very, very happy that God of War came out and is very popular, because this book came out only a couple of years ago. And what it is basically Neil Gaiman decided to take The existing text, like I said, the Poetic Edda and the Prose Edda, which are the two main sources that we have, and take those stories and kind of like do what he can to kind of modernize, like not like set them in contemporary times, but not obviously modernize the language. It's all written in prose, and he kind of like puts it all together into one concrete form instead of the, like, what actually exists is, like, some, like, multiple different versions of the same stories and kind of that stuff. He sort of takes this thing of, like, okay, I'm going to take this bit from this version of the story, this bit from this version of the story, and kind of, like, put them together and make a kind of cohesive telling of the major stories of Norse mythology, which all relate around Odin, Thor, and Loki. And so I think it's a really cool package. I've only read the intro and kind of, like, the first couple of chapters, which mostly tell about the beginning of the universe with Ymir the Giant and all that kind of stuff. But it's really well written. I think it's a smart text. It's pretty short and quick. So I think if you've played God of War and you're interested about the storytelling stuff and like all the stories that Mimir tells and all that kind of stuff, I think this would be an awesome book to pick up. It's very readable. It's very approachable.
I would definitely trust Neil Gaiman to tell me those stories.
Yeah, because one of the things that's interesting is that he is one of the main reasons I know anything about Norse mythology anyways, because Odin, Thor, and Loki are three really significant characters to a couple of volumes of Sandman, the graphic novel series he did. And so that was one of the things I read that got me interested in actual Norse mythology, as opposed to like the Marvel, like, yeah, it's kind of Norse mythology. If you like, you kind of squint at it, it's got Thor and Loki and Odin. They're all pretty different than they are in those stories. All of his stuff in Sandman was based on the actual myths. And so that kind of got me interested into that. So yeah, like he's someone I trust on that as well. The other book I got, which is nowhere near as approachable and is not something I would recommend to someone that is a casual reader or is like casually interested in this stuff, but only mega like lit nerds like me that's like want to actually like dive into some of this shit. J.R.R. Tolkien in the 1930s wrote a retelling of a lot of the stories from the Volsung Saga, which is one of the other like kind of existing texts that deal with Norse mythology. All the dragon stuff in the dragon side quest in God of War kind of touches on characters from the Volsung Saga. But J.R.R. Tolkien in the 1930s decided to rewrite those and kind of like write portions that were missing and that sort of stuff in the original poetic form in modern English. Because for those who don't know, J.R.R. Tolkien was not just like Lord of the Rings guy. Like he was a full like, you know, tenured professor in linguistics and mythology, like one of the leading and most respected translations of Beowulf, English, modern English translations of Beowulf was done by J.R.R. Tolkien.
He taught at Oxford.
He taught at Oxford. Like he
it's
knew
part of
shit.
Why Lord of the Rings took 12 years to write. Yeah. He had a day job.
And it's also one of the reasons why if you're playing God of War, you're like, man, it's just sort of weird that there's like ogres and trolls and elves and shit. Like, isn't that all Lord of the Rings? It's like, no, like, Tolkien got a lot of that stuff from Norse mythology and pulled it in, because one of his ideas with Lord of the Rings was to try to make a unified Anglican version of mythology, which is just, that's a larger discussion to have another day. But anyways, what J.R.R. Tolkien did is sort of rewrite these stories, and then it was released a couple of years ago, or maybe a little, maybe like in the 2000s, with obviously editing by Christopher Tolkien, who's sort of dealt with all that stuff. And it's The Legend of Sigurd and Gudrun. And it's you know, it's a like only for literary nerds text, because only about half of the pages are the actual book. All the rest of it is like the three different, it's got a foreword, it's got three different introductions, it's got commentaries, some of which were written by J.R.R. Tolkien, like about the subjects, and all that kind of stuff. So this is more if you liked some of J.R.R. Tolkien's other writings, like The Children of Húrin or that kind of stuff, that's not like just Lord of the Rings, or like some of the Silmarillion stuff is a bit stylistically like this, you might be interested in picking this book up. I think it's like really cool. I'm really excited to get into it. It's all poetry, so like it's, you know, it's obviously it's narrative poetry, but still don't pick it up and expect like it to be Lord of the Rings.
I am one of those people who fucking loves the poems in Lord of the Rings, though.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'd be into that.
Yeah.
I think Tolkien is such a fascinating guy.
Mm-hmm.
I think if he were alive today, one, he'd be horrified by how we all treat Lord of the Rings. And
yes,
two,
yeah, he would look at fucking the Middle-earth Shadow of Mordor games and just like, I'm checking out of this reality.
I got to come back to life. I don't want it. I'm going back to the grave. Yeah. No, but I think he would look at all those games and he'd say, if you're gonna bastardize my work, could you at least like do a visual novel of Baron and Luthien? Like, what the hell?
Yeah.
This is, come on.
Yeah, then he'd get to work and it's like, well, you know, I there's a couple of other languages I didn't fully invent for Lord of the Rings. I might as well get to that.
Yes. Man, just, it's insane that we still have books of his coming out.
Yeah, that, anyway, that he had so many writings just sort of like around that, yeah they're being discovered and edited and put together.
I know I'm getting you off topic, but it's cool. So yeah, nice. I cannot wait until next week's topic when you have read well into Norse mythology and we will do a live viewing of Thor Ragnarok and you will nitpick the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very different interpretation of Ragnarok. I mean, it's also, it's like, fucking Hel is not Thor and Loki's sister. Like, come on. Like, Hel is Loki's daughter. What the fuck is even going on?
That'd be great. But anyway, it would be the nerdiest Mystery Science Theater 3000 ever.
Yeah. It's just like, let me break out my Penguins Classic Edition of the Volsung Saga and read you this section. Yeah.
It's an 8-hour long. We have to keep pausing so you can read us Norse poems.
Yeah, and it's like, and according to this footnote, yeah.
Well, I am sure we will talk a good deal of Norse mythology later.
Yes, I'm
because
excited to do so.
God of War is chock full of it.
Yeah.
It is, I think they read at least those two books. Probably more.
Yes, probably more, yeah.
They probably at least read the Wikipedia page for Odin.
Probably. They broke into some Snorri Sturluson, which is one of, like, the guy who wrote the prose Edda, which is the best name, Snorri Sturluson.
That should be, if they make another Thor movie, he should make a friend named Snorri Snortleson.
Sturluson,
whatever it is.
Snorri Sturluson is also fine.
But that could be it. Thor keeps mispronouncing the name.
Yeah.
All right. So, let's see. Let's just jump into topics, because, again, no real news, and I didn't want to get into it this week. There was the Red Dead stuff, there are always little things, but fuck it, we've got better stuff to talk about.
Yeah.
Like, I gotta get my Kong on here.
Okay.
And talk about Donkey Kong.
Yes, because this weird crusade you have been on.
So, I have always had this, like, interest in the Donkey Kong Country games that I never fully, like, consummated, like, getting into it. And, I think my entry point, because I did not have a Super NES as a kid, you know?
Yeah.
Was, I mean, I probably did play the games a little bit with their GBA remakes.
I think had Donkey Kong Country 2 on the GBA. That was the one that you played as Diddy and Dixie, but did not play as Donkey. Yeah,
yeah.
That was the one.
I never owned them. I do now for this project. I got them, but I never owned them. But I probably rented them because that was kids renting games was a thing once upon a time.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, so I never really got into it until in 2010 was when Donkey Kong Country Returns came out for the Wii, and that was the first one made by Retro Studios, who made the Metroid Prime trilogy, and they had come back to do a new Donkey Kong, and Donkey Kong hadn't been around for a while, and that game sold like gangbusters. It sold more than the entire Metroid Prime trilogy combined, which I'm sure made some people hang their heads. But anyway, not the people at Retro who were still there. They were probably happy their game sold well. But anyway, you know, that game was a big hit. But I also remember kind of like liking it, but also sort of bouncing off it at the time. Because I didn't quite get what it was, because that game came out in kind of the wave of, like, we'd had new Super Mario Bros.
Right.
And some new, like, Yoshi and Kirby games. And we were getting into, like, these kind of, like, couch co-op Nintendo platforming side-scrolling games that often had a really high difficulty curve. Like, new Super Mario Bros. Wii is pretty tough, but they were Mario tough, not Donkey Kong tough. And Donkey Kong Country Returns is one of the hardest games I've ever played. And I never got through it as a kid in 2010 on the Wii. And I was, like, playing it co-op with my brother. I think we, like, maxed out at World 4. Like, we just could not get through that game. And, so years later, Tropical Freeze came out. I never really played it on the Wii U. I just kind of missed it. Most people did. That game sold less than 1 million copies, which for a Nintendo game is bad. It's a really pretty stark example of what happened to the Wii U, that you went from, like, Donkey Kong Country Returns selling, like, 7 million units to Tropical Freeze just bottoming out and no one played it. But especially, like, when it came out and then over the years, that game has had a true, like, critical reputation build up around it, as I think people have. Because I think part of it is, like, the moment for Donkey Kong came back around, where, like, people started looking at games like that as more than just colorful, cartoony Nintendo games. I think, like, platforming and that kind of design has just had a new vogue, you know? Like, I think evidenced by something like Sonic Mania last year, which would not have been made in the form it was 10 years ago.
Right.
Or even 4 years ago, I think, when Tropical Freeze originally came out. So when it was announced for Switch, I said, all right, I'm going to get this game on Switch. I'm going to play the shit out of it. Looks great. But I need to understand Donkey Kong, because I think I will like these games. And I was actually into this before the Tropical Freeze thing came out, because when the Super NES Classic Edition came out, one of the first games I played all the way through was Donkey Kong Country. And I really enjoyed it. I think it's a great game. I think it's a unique game. It's obviously got one of the best soundtracks of all time. The Donkey Kong Country music is iconic for a good reason. It is the best. And I really, really enjoyed that game. But the Super NES Classic Edition, sadly, only had the first one on it, which I will never fucking understand why they didn't just put 2 and 3 on there and be nice about it. Because here's the thing. 2 and 3 are better.
Yes.
I have discovered definitively. They're just better games.
Diddy and Dixie Kong are better than Donkey Kong.
They are.
That's my feeling on the matter.
Diddy and Dixie Kong are the fucking best. I love them. And I even like Kitty Kong. And other people don't like Kitty Kong, and those people don't have souls. But we'll get into that.
I don't even know who Kitty Kong is.
He is the player character in Donkey Kong Country 3.
Okay.
The side character.
I checked out before I got to Country
3. I'll talk about those. But anyway, so I finally, I decided, because my Wii U has been in a box for a while, and it's not coming back out. Not because I dislike the Wii U, but because it's got, 8,000 cables you have to attach.
Yeah.
And I just moved. And I just can't. I'm moving again soon. I can't do it.
I mean, is the last person who touched your Wii U me? Because, when I played the Breath of the Wild on it?
I think it is, actually. Yeah. Because you played Breath of the Wild. And I think when I got it back from you, I left it in its box.
Probably.
Was, I think, what happened. So, anyway, I finally realized these were all on 3DS. Because the new Nintendo 3DS has Super NES games. So, I bought the whole Donkey Kong Country trilogy. Once I got really into it and realized how much I love these games, I also bought the Donkey Kong Land Trilogy, which are the Game Boy spin-offs that came... They were developed by Rare and came out, 6 months after the Super NES game of the same number. And they were kind of every 6 months you'd get a Donkey Kong game that way. And I've been playing a little bit of those. I have not finished those. I played all of Donkey Kong Country Returns on its 3DS version, which I actually think... Obviously, it has some downgrades because it's the 3DS, not the Wii. But it also has more levels. It has a new mode that is effectively an easy mode, but calling it easy mode for that game is it's not. It's like if they made an easy mode for Dark Souls, you'd be it's still not easy. Let's be honest. So I did play it that way because it allowed me to get through the game faster. But I've played all of them, and I am now two worlds into Tropical Freeze. And why I want to talk about this on the podcast is a little bit is that these are some of my favorite games of all time now. And it is such a cool thing when you go back to games you've heard about and are, maybe parts of pop culture history, but you never quite experienced, and you experience them as more than nostalgia or more than, just an artifact of the time. It's no, this is a addiction for me now. That happened to you with Shenmue.
Yeah, I was about to say it's the Shenmue effect.
Exactly. If maybe I'll give up my I Like Donkey Kong Country award later this year.
Fair enough.
But
yeah.
Yes, to Donkey Kong Country 2 or something.
Yeah.
But anyway, I love these games. And honestly, as someone who loves Nintendo platformers and is so interested in the design and history of them, I think by a pretty wide margin, I think the Donkey Kong Country games are the best Nintendo platformers.
Hmm.
There are some games I would put above some entries, I think Super Mario World is a better game than Donkey Kong Country Returns or something. But as a whole, if you asked me, which Nintendo platforming series or sub-series would I most like to play, every day of the week, at least right now, it would be the Donkey Kong Country games. Because I think, and it's hard to explain, but there's something so fucking unique and creative and energetic and precise about what those games do, particularly the original Rare trilogy, which is just such a shot of utter magic and technical invention that holds up, I think, 100% today. They hold up as well as any Super NES game I think possibly could. They're so amazing. And I fucking love these games. And I also think, the progression of the series is fascinating. Because what they do in that original trilogy, Rare did, is you have that first game, Donkey Kong Country, which I think is really good. But if it were just that game, I would not say what I'm saying right now. I think it's a really, really good platformer, great at times, but it also has some frustrations. I don't think they'd ironed it all out yet. Diddy Kong is so much more fun to play as than Donkey Kong in that game. There's a problem there, I think, yeah, in terms of balancing and stuff. But what they do with the sequels is so fascinating. Because you go from that, where the first game you have Donkey and Diddy. And then Donkey Kong Country 2, Diddy's Kong Quest. It took me a while to figure out what the pun was there. But anyway. Because forever I read it as Diddy Kong's Quest. I did just a dyslexic thing and did not read the whole...
Yeah.
I just read the whole thing and I was like, oh, no. It's Diddy's Kong Quest. There we go. The Quest for Kong. And that game, Donkey Kong has been kidnapped. And so Diddy gets his girlfriend, Dixie Kong... which I hope that's like a tribal name or something, and they're not like sister and brother.
You know, it's, you know, reading some mythology stuff, there's a lot of incest. It's, you know, the creation myth of Earth involves a lot of Kongs having sex with a lot of other Kongs.
They're apes. It doesn't matter as much. But anyway.
Sure. That's how biology works.
Not biologically, I, you know, okay. Morally.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, you know, we're apes too, right?
Yes, yes. Anyway, Diddy Kong, so the second one you're playing is Diddy and Dixie is the best Donkey Kong character because she's got this fucking ponytail and can fly, and she's just awesome. And if you've played it, if you've heard of it, you know, Donkey Kong Country 2 is one of the best games ever made. Like, I think that's, like, one thing people on that series generally agree on, and there's a lot of disagreement on different eras of this series, which I find fascinating, but that's the one that I think people generally point to, even though it's more of maybe a cult classic than, like, a Mario World is,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But Diddy's Conquest, one of the best games ever made, easily one of the best soundtracks of all time. That one is David Wise hitting it so far out of the park. I think that music was at least 20 years ahead of its time, because I think we're still generally not at a place as interesting musically as like David Wise was on that game for games of Donkey Kong Country's ilk. But even like if you take a lot of like 3D games like a God of War or an Uncharted or something, oftentimes they have good music, but they don't do nearly as much to commit to the atmosphere as I think Donkey Kong Country's games do. And Donkey Kong Country 2, just the level design, the sheer variety, the absolute pitch-perfect pairing of Diddy Kong and Dixie Kong, who are pretty equally fun to play as, useful in different areas, and are just such a fun team. And of course, my favorite thing in that whole game is when you hit the level, like the end screen at the end. You know, you have to hit this like target thing to end the level, and then each character has a separate animation for that. Right. Dixie pulls out a guitar and does this shred and guitar solo that's awesome, but Diddy Kong pulls out a boombox.
It was the 90s.
It's so awesome. Every single time it happened, I danced with it, because it's like a Persona game. Like, it's, you just have to dance with it because it is so fucking groovy. And like that game just has attitude and style and the chops of just perfect platforming design. And then I was a little intimidated to play Donkey Kong Country 3, because that's the one people shit on. It's like,
yeah, that's the less sentiment I've heard for sure.
People are wrong. That game is fucking brilliant. I don't know if it's as quote-unquote good as Donkey Kong Country 2, but to me it's like roughly on par. I think that series absolutely has the effect of like the Bourne trilogy or something, where you have a first entry that's pretty darn great, and then the next two are just insanely good, and I think like flip a coin which one you like more, they're both fucking great. And I really like Diddy's this third one. Now Donkey and Diddy have been kidnapped, and so Dixie is the hero, and she has her little cousin Kitty Kong, who's a baby Kong, but he's big and he's in like a onesie. It's weird.
Okay, yeah.
But I do like him. I think he's a cute little character. And so Dixie and Kitty are the characters this time, and they are in the northern Kremosphere, where the Kremlings come from.
Yeah.
And they're going there, and that one has a different world map where you have like this little glider ship thing where you go around the map, and that's how you go find like the different worlds to go explore. And I think all that's really fun. I think like the exploration side of that game is leaps and bounds above the other two. Some of the level design maybe is not, but I also, what I like about Donkey Kong Country 3 and why I think other people don't like it as much is it's a much slower game. It's slower paced. Levels are much more cerebral in how they're put together. They're a little more puzzle oriented. They're more exploration oriented. They're usually built around some kind of level gimmick, but I like those gimmicks. I think they're fun. Like each level introduces some kind of mechanic you kind of have to get used to, and I think it does it really well. But it is undeniably like different than the other games. But I think it's really good. It has such a unique tone. People also shit on the music from that game. It's amazing. Like, I guess if you put it up to Donkey Kong Country 2, is the soundtrack as good? Probably not. But I don't know. That's like rejecting the Persona 3 music because you like the Persona 5 music more. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's a weird thing to me. It's all great, and it's all of a piece, I think. So I just love these three games. Donkey Kong Country 3, I thought I was maybe even kind of tapping out because I played these out of order. And I did 1, 2, Donkey Kong Country Returns. And then I'm like, do I have time for 3? God of War is coming out. But I just like tried it one night, and in that one night I played 2 whole worlds and I was just addicted to it. And I just, those games are so good. So I think the original Rare trilogy, just I think the tone and atmosphere of it, as I said, unparalleled. It controls so well, so fluidly. It's actually amazing to me when I was going back and forth between Returns, the new game, newish game, it's 8 years old now,
right.
But the new game and some of the old Rare games. And I actually think the Rare games in general control better in a lot of ways. And it's just, it's such a crazy thing to be able to say that about games separated by 15 years of time. I think Rare was just really on the ball then. And I also think those games are graphically beautiful. There's something about, I think some games from this era did it better than others. But the whole pre-rendered graphics thing, which we really only had for those couple years in the 90s,
yeah.
Where you have those backgrounds, like Final Fantasy VII is probably the most famous example of it outside of this. But I think those can often be really beautiful, depending on how you put them together, because they're like these, because they're not real time, it's like these interesting dynamic little like dioramas you have in the background, and everything happens like against that. I think Final Fantasy VII is occasionally a pretty clunky implementation of that. Not by anyone's fault, it's just, it's 1997. Yeah.
They also had to do a lot more of that, the Donkey Kong Country,
yes.
The length of the game.
Absolutely. But Donkey Kong Country, I think there's something about that mixed with the, like, 3D, the pseudo-3D graphics they do for the main characters, and how it all mixes together, and Rare's utterly beautiful art style, and especially in the sequels, 2 and 3, how many different kinds of places they take you to, and what sorts of environments they're able to illustrate that no one could have with normal, like, pixel art back in the day. You just couldn't have gone to some of these places, you know, and had these kinds of interesting environments you would have had. And so I just think they're stunningly beautiful games to look at. And I really love playing. I was playing these on 3DS, you know, little screen, actually sub the resolution they originally came out at, but they still look great on there. And I was constantly blown away by that, plus the music. And then I do think it's a fascinating thing to transition to this new series of games made by Retro Studios, who are obviously insanely talented developers, but, you know, Metroid Prime is a very different beast than Donkey Kong.
Yeah.
And they made that transition so smoothly. You know, I think Donkey Kong Country Returns has some issues. I do think there are points where they go too far with the difficulty. That is the hardest game I have ever beat, probably. And I'm playing the sequel right now, so that will probably change, because I think Tropical Freeze is even harder, although the challenge feels more fair and fun in Tropical Freeze. I think it's better balanced from what I've seen so far. But overall, like, Returns really is an interesting thing because Retro totally took this series and made it their own. And I think it's an interesting case study because these are both examples of Nintendo giving one of their big characters to a Western developer. Rare is a Western developer, obviously, and Retro is based out of Austin, Texas. And that had worked very well with them for, you know, Metroid, and Rare had done some little things for Nintendo before. But these are just both, I think, super interesting examples of that, where this is a... this is a Japanese-style game in its DNA, right? Because
right.
This kind of platformer was invented by Nintendo and these kinds of people. So you pass it over to these Western developers, and what kinds of like takes do they do on it is just a super interesting thing to me, and the ways Rare and Retro are so different. Like, one of the things Retro does is your main player character in the Retro games is Donkey Kong. You don't play as the other characters. And I do miss that from the original games, except what they did is, with one of the things they're able to do with modern technology is make Donkey Kong a much more interesting, playable character, because they're really able to convey his weight.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you listen to it with headphones and you watch him lumber along, the way he moves on, like, his front legs, and he just has so much weight, like, sound to his movements, and, you know, he'll start slowly and gain speed as he goes because he's heavy, and so he moves faster the more he goes, and just the way, like, he jumps, and now you have to time those things. Like, the physics engine of these new Donkey Kong games, I think, is fascinating and really, really accomplished. And then Returns is just, it's you know, it's kind of a nostalgia fest. It's a lot of throwbacks to stuff the other games did more than it is inventing its own stuff. But it is still just, I think, a top-notch platformer, and a much more, I think, inventive and interesting one than a lot of the, like, throwback platformers we were getting in the era that came out, like a new Super Mario Bros., which I like a lot. But this is just, I think, a manifestly better and more interesting game, but also something that you can tell why it threw people off when it came out, and why I think Tropical Freeze landed with a bit of a thud, is that these are, like, real hardcore platforming games, and difficult games don't look like Donkey Kong anymore, you know?
Right.
They don't look cartoony, and I think that was an alienating factor for a lot of people, including me when I was a kid, and coming back to it with a fuller understanding, I found that game immensely rewarding, and I really love the 3DS version. I think the 3D is good. The Wii version has all these waggle controls that make it hard to play a very precise platformer. So the 3DS, you get to just use buttons, and that's very nice. Who'd have thunk it? Buttons.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
They're nice.
They're very nice. And it just looks good, and it doesn't run at a full 60, obviously, because it's the 3DS, but I still love that game on that system. And now we have Tropical Freeze out on the Switch, and holy shit, every single thing I've heard people say about this game for 4 years is so utterly manifestly true. Donkey Kong Country Returns is good. Tropical Freeze, Two Worlds In, I can say, isn't just great. Like, it's going to be one of those games, unless it like takes a dive from where I am right now, that I will be thinking about come Game of the Decade time next year, you know, for that top 10 list, because we're going to be doing that next year.
God.
It's going to be crazy. Anyway, and it is just, visually, it is stunning, you know, full HD, 60 FPS, and these beautiful tropic environments. Every world is a different island with a truly, like, unique theme to it, and the way they build levels are, there's fewer levels, but they are longer and more complicated. And I think it's actually a really beautiful, interesting mix of like the Donkey Kong Country 2 versus 3 ethos of sort of like tight, engaging platforming versus sort of, you know, gimmick mechanic driven stuff, where Tropical Freeze is this perfect blend with all of the more, you know, specific physics based stuff Retro had brought into the series. I love all of that. The music is the biggest step up, because Donkey Kong Country Returns, the original, was just recycled music from the original, not even the original trilogy, just the original game, Donkey Kong Country. Not literally they use the same tracks, but like remixes and stuff, with a couple of new tracks that are good. The remixes were done by Kenji Yamamoto, who is the Metroid composer. And there's one track in Donkey Kong Country Returns that is absolutely and obviously a Metroid song. That, like, he must have, like, written for a different Metroid game and not used, and it's the weirdest, like, cognitive dissonance to me.
Yeah, because that's two really different styles of music.
Very different.
Yeah, one is like, bah, 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 yeah, and then another's like, super atmospheric, dark sci-fi story.
Yes. But for Tropical Freeze, they got David Wise back, who doesn't compose for enough games anymore.
Yeah.
And he wrote a whole new score for Tropical Freeze, and when I say whole new, I mean every fucking level has its own music. Not like, this level type has its own music. Every level has its own music. And it is unbelievable. It is some of the best video game music I have ever heard. Because, again, like, David Wise hasn't been composing much lately. The last time you've probably heard music of his you truly remember was, like, maybe the N64 days. Mm-hmm. You know, technology has come a ways. He can just make music now and not have to worry about any technical limitations. Like, there's a level in this game, I think it's Windmill Hills, that has, like, a harmonica main line in it. It's one of the most amazing things for a video game I've ever heard. So, like, you put that together, the level design, the challenge, the creativity, it's just fucking beautiful, amazing. They've added extra Helper Kong, so you can play as, you don't play as them, but they're with you, Diddy, and then they've added Dixie and Cranky Kong, which I think is hilarious. Cranky Kong does the Scrooge McDuck move of bouncing on his cane, which is awesome. But I love playing as each of them, and they're a little more helpful to the player than like Diddy Kong was in Returns. So you're not literally controlling Dixie, but she still has her ponytail and does the ponytail related moves, and that's very helpful. But I am loving this game. I love this whole series. But now we do have to talk about the experience I had the other night.
Okay.
This was the day the game came out, and I played through the first two. I'm playing it very thoroughly because one of the ways I think Retro does collectibles very intelligently in these games is that in the old games, the rare ones, you could get Kong letters in each level.
Right.
You could find the K-O-N-G. And in the rare games, that would give you an extra life. Nice, but not essential all the time. Sometimes very essential.
Yeah.
Depends on how you're playing it. But in the retro games, the Kong letters, if you get all of them for each level in a world, you get an extra level in that world. And it's like a challenge level. And if you beat all of the challenge levels, you get an extra world with new levels, which I think is a really cool way to do it.
Right.
And like, the Kong letters are specifically placed in challenging places where you're not going to miss seeing them, but it will take a little extra effort to go get them. So like, you are rewarded for challenge with more challenge, which is cool. I think it's a very smart system. So I did World 1, great, loved it. The last level was challenging, but like fun. Did World 2, loved it, it's also good. Get to the challenge level, it's 11:45 at night, and I'm thinking, okay, I'll knock this one out, I'll go beat the boss, and then I'll go to bed. And that'll be, you know, maybe it'll be 12:30 and I'll be good to go. I beat the challenge level at 3 in the morning.
Okay.
Did not go play the boss. Did not do that. went to bed, felt physically ill from exhaustion and fatigue, and woke up just kind of hating myself.
Okay, first question, why did you not stop and go to sleep and try again the next day?
I did realize something the next morning that I think helps explain this.
Okay.
When I got up in the morning, went into the bathroom, morning routine, looked at my anxiety medication and realized I hadn't taken it in 2 days. And I think I have to say, I have anxiety. I know that. That's like a diagnosable thing. We're getting real now.
Yeah.
I think I'm also obsessive compulsive in some ways. I don't know. I've never been like analyzed for that. But I think the Donkey Kong thing kind of proves it. Because, Sean, I can't tell you how much I wanted to stop at, like, 12:30 and say, I will try this tomorrow. It doesn't matter. It's a cartoon fucking monkey.
It's an ape. Hey.
It's an ape. Sorry. It's a cartoon ape and a bunch of penguins I have to bounce on. It doesn't matter. I can let go. And I would say that, and then I would just hear the other side of my brain say, you're not going to sleep if you don't beat this. You're going to hate yourself. You have to. There's just a bunch of cartoon penguins. You have to do this, Jonathan. And it was... I realized how unhealthy it was probably at, 1:30 in the morning this is compulsive behavior going on here. I think if I had taken my meds, it wouldn't have happened. I think it would have controlled it. But no, I got compulsive about it. It's the hardest level I have ever seen in a video game. The whole thing is... I have my Switch with me. I should just pull it out. I'm not going to do that because I would not recover in time for the rest of this podcast discussion. But what it is it's called Bopopolis. And the whole idea is that there's no platforms in the level. You have to bop on the heads of enemies to get through the level. It's a challenge level, so there's no checkpoints. It's a lot less forgiving. And the move you have to execute perfectly throughout that level is the bop, which is probably the shakiest mechanic in the retro games, because what you have to do is when you hit an enemy, if you just bounce on an enemy and don't hit any button, you kind of bounce a little bit off their head and keep going. And they probably die if they're an easy enemy, right? Mm-hmm. But if you press the jump button at the right time while bouncing on their head, you will get a big boost off of them. And in Donkey Kong Country Returns, I'll be honest, I never quite figured out what the hell the timing was, and it is notorious in Returns for being both weirdly precise timing and also indecipherable to figure out timing, and it's just a poorly rendered mechanic. But that game also doesn't make you use it that much. In Tropical Freeze, they did fix the mechanic. It is much more forgiving. It feels like a regular video game mechanic until you do a whole level comprised of it, where you're shooting out of a barrel onto an enemy and have to execute it without ever having hit the floor. And I had to learn to get good at it and figure out what the hell is going on, because literally the first jump of that level took me 20 lives to figure out. Because what you have to do is hit jump before you hit them, and then hold it a little bit after you get off. But if there's another enemy you want to bop off of, you have to release and then hit it again in time, and it is a timing game. Now, when you get into it, the great thing about these games, and I think this is true about platforming in general, is when you are on in a good platformer, it feels like you are making music with the game. It's the sensation of playing an instrument, you know?
Sure.
It's a wonderful thing when you get it going, and then you fail over and over again. Same as with an instrument, I guess.
Yeah.
But anyway, so you get into the rhythm of it, but what this level is constantly you will make, one step forward, and then the next thing is something you are not going to see coming, and it will kill you, and you will go back, and you will have to figure out how to master that. But to master that, you're going to have to play through everything you got through so far, you know? So it is devilishly challenging. I would get to a part where, I would be able to do the first, 30 seconds of the level reliably without even thinking about it, but then there would be a new challenge that would take me many, many tries to do. I started the evening with 54 lives. Because you rack up a lot of lives in Tropical Freeze. Tropical Freeze is one of those games that I look at and that's why they got rid of lives in Super Mario Odyssey. Because there's no reason to have them. Because all the game over does is that it sends you back to... It's the same level. You don't lose any progress. You just... Anything you collected in the level, you don't have anymore. That's the only, penalty. But otherwise, you just get to keep playing. There's no reason to have lives. It's a weird system that platformers are going to at some point need to figure out what to do about. And Mario Odyssey, I think, found a good approach to that. But anyway, you do have lives in this. I started with 54 lives. I did finally game over about 2:20 in the morning. Okay. And that's when I finally decided to kind of take a different approach. But anyway, it wasn't that I only did 50 tries between then. I probably did 200 or 300 tries because you're constantly getting new lives because there's so many bananas in the level.
Okay.
And things to get. So I would maybe lose a life every three tries, something like that, you know, depending on where I got to in the level. Because if you get deep enough, you're getting multiple lives in one run. But anyway, you know, like, there's this one part where you have to jump off multiple owls to get through, and I had to figure out that timing. And that was fucking such a bitch. But, like, half an hour later, I got it, and I never had trouble on that part again, really, or something, you know. But it would just keep going. And the part where I really felt the depths of despair, Sean, late in the level. Not the end. I kept thinking I was at the end, and I wasn't. Is these penguins come at you. And they're flying penguins, and they're the first enemies in the level that are moving targets, laterally moving. There are a lot of enemies that move up and down, but those aren't that hard. If they're moving, like, horizontally, that's a lot tougher to time your jumps, because, again, you don't have anything to fall back on. And those penguins, man, I legitimately thought maybe this level is impossible. I'm looking it up. It's like, what the hell do you do with these penguins? But I finally figured that out. And there's more after the penguins. And there's more after that. And it just keeps going. The penguins were the hardest thing. Eventually what I did after my first game over is at this point, so you get banana coins in the game too.
Okay.
And banana coins are a currency you use at Funky's shop to go get items. Now, when I went into that level, I probably had 80 banana coins. But there's a system in the retro games where once you have jumped off three successive enemies, you start getting a banana coin with each hop on an enemy's head. And there are strings of enemies in that level that are like 10 enemies deep. And so with one run, if you get far enough, you're getting like 50 banana coins. At this point, when I got the game over, I had the max. I had 999. I had maxed out banana coins.
Fuck.
So I was able to spend, and I bought a bunch of Dixie Kong barrels and started bringing them into the level with me. And the thing is, so when you get items, you load your inventory before going into the level. And I was able to take three Dixie Kong barrels at a time. So I would have three tries, then I would have to back out and reload my Dixie barrels and then go back in. And it only took me another, like, 40 minutes once I started doing that to beat the level. But I did do
only
it.
40.
Only 40 minutes. Because Dixie, her thing is, she's kind of like, Diddy is a rocket booster. And he'll go, but he goes, like, straight up and you can strafe a little bit. But Dixie, her hair thing kind of, because it waves a little more, you can get more movement on it when you hold the B button and hold the jump button. Because she will even give you a little burst up. And it's really helpful on this level. And I was kicking myself for not trying it earlier. I actually thought, because I think this is the way it is, in the first game, you couldn't bring a helper in with you.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize until later. So I tried it with Dixie, got through more, still was dying a lot, those fucking penguins. But I got through it with Dixie at the end. And I remember when I got to the end and, like, you get to the screen where, like, you have won. I wasn't even, like, done. It was playing the animation. I dropped the controller. My whole body just went limp. And I just, like, fell on the couch. And I just let out this... Like, it was, like, I had been holding in breath for 3 hours, and I didn't even see the animation of what I won. It was just, like, I couldn't move for, like, 5 more minutes, and then I was finally able to get up, go upstairs, brush my teeth, and go to bed, and it was, like, the worst feeling, but also kind of the best feeling, but I don't know, Sean... I've only played one more level in the game since then. I've been really scarred.
Understandable.
That was an unhealthy thing I did to myself, Sean.
So how long do you estimate, like, a full run of that section takes? Like, you beat that level. How long was that? Like, a minute? 2 minutes?
2 minutes tops.
Okay, yeah.
Two minutes tops.
And so
hundreds of times.
Hundreds of times.
Hundreds of times. And hundreds of times getting fairly deep into it. You know, at a certain point, I wasn't losing in the first 30 seconds, you know?
Okay, so you didn't have that much of that phenomenon. Because what happens to me sometimes is that thing of... You know, I'm doing some really challenging boss fight or something in Dark Souls.
I know what you're going to say.
Yeah, and it's like, on like your third attempt, you get this like, oh, I have like 3 more hits and I would have won. It's like, ah, fuck, I died. And it's like, then for like the next 30 tries, you don't even get halfway through.
Yes, that did happen to me a lot. Like the earliest stuff I never really died on. But like, yes, anytime I saw the penguins, it was just a fact that I would not see them again for half an hour. Just... And I would start losing on parts where I had not... And that's the time, I should say, that's when you walk away.
Uh-huh.
Because I guarantee you, I've experienced... I know this, mental...
Yes.
I know this, that if you come back to it like an hour later, a day later, whatever, you will get further than you would trying it again right then. Because you will still have the skills, but you won't have the fatigue and the frustration, right?
Yeah, and you like... I think you get in that cycle, you start psyching yourself out about it. It's like you failed at this part, you know you should have succeeded... And so then you're, like, self-conscious about it, is what I feel like happens to me.
There was a point, like, in the 2 a.m. hour where I got into, like, true existential despair in my head.
Oh, that's some Dark Souls shit, yeah.
Of, like, what are you doing with your life, Jonathan? You like Donkey Kong, but it's not worth this. It's just a cartoon ape. What the fuck? You have nothing. You have no friends. You have no life. You're single. What is wrong with you, Jonathan? You blew $60 on this fucking game. You have no money. You know, like, it's like a lot of things that weren't even true just going through my head. And it's like, really, this takes nothing actually away from my life. I just wasted 3 hours of sleep. But, like, you get into these doldrums of, like, I hate the world.
Yeah.
I definitely got into despair about, like, Trump's president, nothing matters, all that kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, it's, you definitely go through those stages, and, like I definitely hit the stage of where I start just getting mad at the game and being like, this is the fucking game, like, this mechanic fucking sucks.
Yep.
This is like, the music in this level sucks, too. And it's like, the character design sucks, and the people who made this game sucks, and everything sucks.
I know. It was a weird night. Games are a weird thing, because what? There's no other medium you do that with.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you don't go to a museum and look at a painting and then look at it for 3 more hours, unable to walk away and getting frustrated. Like, fucking Van Gogh, such a good painter. This sunflower is too good to look away from.
I will say the only other thing, and another medium I think is somewhat equivalent to that, is if you're reading a book that is just like... like you're reading fucking, I don't know, some Beowulf or like the Canterbury Tales in Middle English. You just read the same thing like 5 times or something. What the fuck are you saying? What the, like, you're reading like some like high fucking lit theory Foucault bullshit that's been like translated by some asshole from French into the most incomprehensible English you've ever seen. It's like, this motherfucker, what the fuck are you even saying? That's the only thing that's even close to what you're describing.
I mean, I've certainly experienced somewhat similar feelings when I'm watching like a 3-hour Russian film about a sad guy in the snow, which is every Russian film, and I'm at the screening. But the thing then is, I can just go to sleep, and that's what I do to get out of those situations.
And also, the thing is that like the movie, and it's the same with like every other medium other than like movies and games, is that the medium just happens to you. Like with the movie, you're just sitting there, and if you don't understand what's happening, it's fine. It's like if it's a book, if you're trying to move past that, you're not going to understand anything that's happening at all. It's like, you have to actively turn each page and read each word and try to grapple with it that way. And then in games, it's like, you don't even get to turn the page. It's the next level up. It's like, no, motherfucker, like, you just have to keep on doing this over and over again until you either succeed or you give up.
Yeah. Because you also get the sensation where, like, you're going to do less well over time just by the basic thing of your hand gets sweaty on the controller and it's harder to press the button.
And it's 3 in the morning and you should have gone to sleep 2 hours ago.
Like, Sean, literally, when I was getting in bed and I'm like, you know, putting an alarm up on my phone, like my hands are shaking and like I don't have full faculty of my fingers.
Yeah.
And it's like, why do we do this? It's because Tropical Freeze is a great fucking game. You should all play it. Here's the thing, though. I'll say, the big attraction of the Switch version is they have added a funky mode.
Yes.
The marquee features, you can play as Funky Kong.
The best of the Kongs.
In that mode, you can still play as Donkey Kong and the other Kongs, but you can also choose to play as Funky, who has extra things. I would, if you have not played a Donkey Kong game before, or you've casually, just start in Funky mode. You can still get all the same game. What it does is it's very similar to the 3DS Easy mode. It gives you an extra couple of hearts. It gives you more items in the shop to buy. It's just more lenient with certain things. They've added some other nice features to make it easier. It in no way is going to get rid of the challenge, but it's going to make it more accessible. And I think that's great. Like, especially because they've preserved... I'm playing the original mode just because I've never played it and I want to get that. But there's no shame in like going to play Funky mode. It is not a play the game for you mode. It is just a less insane mode. Again, like what I would imagine if Dark Souls ever had an easy mode, that's kind of probably what it would be like. It would not be, now this is an accessible game for people who only play Wii Sports.
Yeah.
This is not what that is, but if you've never played one, you should play Tropical Freeze. Don't be afraid to play Funky Mode.
So I'm very excited to hear you talk about when you play Dark Souls Remastered and...
I'm scared, Sean. Is that the whole game? Is it all that hard? Like, what's the...
No. Like it's the... There are sections, and it's mostly some of the boss fights.
Okay.
Can be incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
But it is definitely that thing of each time you die, if you think about it, you can come away with information that's like, okay, if I approach it this way the next time, I can do this. But it's like, the Dark Souls games are not particularly forgiving in letting you make mistakes. Like, if you make a couple of mistakes, you're going to die.
Yeah.
In most video games, it's like, you know, like playing God of War, even playing God of War on hard mode, I can be pretty messy in most fights and be fine. And, right. like, there is no fight in Dark Souls that you can be messy and you just are fine. It's like, the most wimpy enemy will still be able to kill you if you just fuck shit up too much.
Okay. I think, and there is something about a hard platformer is a special kind of beast because, yeah. like, you have to, like, think about how you, like, press the button and win. And, like, it is a true, like, mental gauntlet at points. And, you know, most of Donkey Kong Country Tropical Freeze or any other Donkey Kong game is not near that level. But they are hard. Like, they're much harder than Mario games or Sonic games, I think. And it's just, it's an interesting phenomenon. But I love these games. I think they're the best 2D side-scrollers, whatever era you play. And once I've finished Tropical Freeze, I can do a nice top five ranking for y'all.
Well, I'm excited to hear you talk about next week, the next challenge room you hit, that you stay up for 48 hours straight trying to beat.
I did find some consensus on the internet that the one I was stuck on is the hardest one in the game.
The thing about that one, it sounds like, kind of going to the experience I had with God of War yesterday, which is nowhere near as severe as what you just had, because I approached it like a sane person,
yes.
was one of, so there are there's this like combat challenge thing you open up in God of War near the end of the game, and you kind of go through them, and some of them are pretty difficult. And I'm playing on the hard difficulty, which isn't the hardest difficulty. I'm almost certainly going to play through this game on the hardest difficulty because I'm a fucking asshole. That's what I do. But I'm not on that one. But I'm still harder than normal. And so those, like, the normal set of God of War like combat challenges are difficult, but were pretty doable. But then you unlock a tier. Once you do all of them, you unlock a tier above that called the Impossible Challenge. And the way those combat challenges work is they both is like a bunch of enemies thrown together and like you have to clear them all. But they typically have another like condition on top of them. The one that I ran into that was problematic for me, which I think shares a condition similar to what you're describing with Donkey Kong, was if you get hit once you fail and you have to restart the trial from the beginning. And it was like 20 enemies, I think, that you have to kill. And that was one that it was that thing of like, on the fifth one, I got to a point where an ancient spawns, which is basically the last enemy you're going to kill, and he spawns in and there's like him and seven other enemies, and I died to him the first time, and then it took me like 50 more tries to get there. Now, like, most tries were just like, oh, that was like 30 seconds because I got hit by this fucking asshole I didn't pay attention to. But it was definitely that same thing of like, I knew I could do it, and just got into this cycle of being like, but I'm not doing it because I'm just like one stupid fucking thing hits me. And it's any of those challenges where it's like one mistake. You yep. can't fuck up even once. Like, you can't miss that timing on the jump. You can't miss the timing on this block. No, if you fuck up one time, you have to start all the way from the beginning. And that is the most excruciating thing a video game can do to you.
It really is. And, you know, I think a game can... And that's, we're not talking about the extreme end, right? Like, these are both specific challenge levels.
Yes, you in no way have to do this to play the game. And you should only do it if you're an idiot masochist.
Sure. But, like, I think God of War in its combat and Donkey Kong Country Tropical Freeze in, like, its normal level design leverage that kind of thing in really satisfying ways, I think, generally, right?
Yes,
of like,
yeah, absolutely.
You know, generally one mistake won't kill you, but a couple might, and it is fun to play it in that sense of like, there's kind of this constant tension, but also this constant discovery, and there's enough leniency to let you do that discovery. I think it's the sign of any kind of skill-based game can do that really well. And God of War winds up being more of one than I think I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, absolutely.
But let's talk about God of War. Let's get into it. So we talked about the gameplay a lot last time. I'm sure we'll touch on it again because we've played more of it, obviously. And this game has a pretty, I think, deep relationship between gameplay and storytelling. And that's one of the good things about it. But, so Sean, I beat it. I have also gone on and platinumed the entire thing. And I will talk about some of that later. And you have beat the game and you are in the process of cleaning everything up.
Yeah, I'm pretty, like, the only things I have left to do is I have to finish all the stuff in Niflheim. And there's, I think, two Valkyries. And then probably there's, like, whatever the boss you open up after you do all the Valkyries I have to do.
No boss. You just hang out.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, that's, you're picking up all these helmets just to decorate your house.
Yep. You and your son have a picnic with the helmets.
Yep. You just hang out. You, your son, your buddy, the head. It's just a great time.
Let's be clear. Spoilers from here on out.
Yeah.
Spoilers in 5, 4, 3, 2. Oh my God! Thanos won at the end. Wait.
Yeah. No. Thanos appears and he and your son turns it to dust right in front of your eyes, and so does Mimir. Mimir's like, I don't want to go, Kratos.
I think that'd be pretty great.
Yeah, it's the crossover you weren't expecting.
So we really did not talk about the story much at all last time, other than saying we liked it.
Yes, and like kind of establishing the premise, I think, was the furthest.
Yeah. Point. Now that we've finished the game, I guess we'll just start here. Yeah. You know, we've seen the whole scope of it. I'm curious to see how you thought the story kind of shook out, how you feel it plays. It goes in directions I was not expecting in the final hours, and I also think the final hours are batshit crazy wonderful.
Yeah.
But I also have some questions about it, so I'm mm-hmm. curious, and I'm curious what you thought about it.
Yeah, I like the story a lot. I have there's a couple of things I have some problems with, mostly to do with pacing. I think there's a point, like, three-fourths of the way through the game where they pull a thing of just, like, there's a still, like, I think all throughout the game they do a really great job of developing the Kratos-Atreus relationship, which is the heart of the game. Like, that character stuff is great throughout. I think there's a point where you hit, like, there's not, like, a lot of, like, vertical progression in the plot. There's, like, you have all this great sort of, like, expansive lore and character stuff going on, but particularly I think, for me, it's exactly when you and Baldur fight for the second time and destroy the gate to Jotunheim. It's like, fuck, like, you have to do, like, a whole other set of challenges and then a whole other set of challenges to get to Jotunheim, and I think it just spends too much time dawdling there to get you to, like, the end of the game, and I think that stuff should have been shored up better because it started getting a bit tedious. But other than that, I really like the game. I love the ending. I love once you get, like, once it starts sort of, like, twiddling its thumbs and it's like, okay, now we're setting in for, like, the last big encounter with Baldur and you getting to Jotunheim and, like, finishing the story. I think all that stuff is great. But there's that one little section that I think needed to be tuned up. That feels like something got cut or something around there. I feel like maybe that second trip to Helheim got cut short or something, that, like, there's not a whole lot that goes on there.
But I guess it's a weird thing for me because I agree completely on, like, an intellectual level of, I think, the nuts and bolts storytelling of how do we get characters from point A to point B gets super rocky in the second half of this game, because the goal, but this is something I commend, though, the goal of the game from when Kratos is chopping down that tree in the beginning to when the credits roll at the end is you're going to get to the highest point in the Nine Realms and you're going to scatter the Mother's ashes. That is always the goal. The problem is, you know, you get to the top of that mountain for the first time, like, 2 hours into the game.
Yeah, and depending on how many side quest things you do.
Yeah, absolutely. But this could be, like, a 60-hour game, conceivably. You know, however long you... there's no play clock. Western games need play clocks. What the hell y'all doing? Yeah. But anyway, so I don't know how long I spent. But it was dozens of hours, right?
Yes.
And the goal is still to get to the top of a mountain. And for a while, it's still to get to the top of that same mountain and then just use a portal, right?
Yeah.
So... it's kind of hard to make a game where the goal continues to be get to the top of the mountain. And there does come a point where, like, when we were climbing that mountain to do it, like, before Baldur destroys it, you know, I was thinking, this probably isn't the end of the game, but if it isn't, they're going to have to do something super clunky here to keep this thing going. Yeah. And they do. They have to do something very contrived, and then they have to do something very contrived again. And about three more times, the one that I rolled my eyes at hardest is when you are in the room of, like, the realm shift room.
Yes.
And you start the process and you think you're going to finish the game. And then Mimir's like, wait, this won't work. We don't have the infinity gem we need.
He needs both of his eyes.
Yes. You have to go get his eyes, which that's actually closer to the end than I thought at the time. But, like, that is one of those moments that is just the game. There are more scenes to have and the game needs to go on. And I don't know if it's that something got cut as much as the one-shot aesthetic of this thing means that they have no ability to, like, do compression of time. And I think 99% of the game works very well for them. But when you have to connect all these, I think, different set pieces and ideas they had to put together, there is just naturally going to be some contrivance, I think, to put, like, get characters back on the path they need to go on to have that encounter. Because I think, like, the whole second trip to Helheim is a fucking amazing sequence. Yeah. But some of the things surrounding that to get there, like, in the back of my mind, I'm like, yeah, the nuts and bolts of this are kind of clunky. But I also just jumped off the top of that mountain onto a dragon and had a fight with Baldur on it.
That section is fucking nuts. But that's
what I mean. So there is some contrived storytelling, but I also thought, like, in terms of pound for pound, scene for scene, I think that's the best stretch of the game in terms of narrative of, like, what set pieces they have, where it takes you, what moments Kratos has with Atreus. Like, it was when I was most engaged with the story. So, yes, I rolled my eyes a couple of times, but I also thought, like, every time you get out of whatever learning what the next MacGuffin is, the hunt for that MacGuffin was fucking amazing.
Yeah. And it's the kind of thing that it's one of the reasons why I want to play the game again, both because I want to see what the hardest difficulty is like, but also I suspect that those issues for me will be easier, like paved over a bit on another playthrough, because I think one of the things I was expecting was it to have more of a like filmic structure, and like a filmic structure to this with like the three act structure would be at the end of act two, you get to the top of Jotunheim and then realize there's something that we need, something else we need to do. Like we need to go back and we need to help Freya. And like that would be the, like that would be act three. Like that's how that would normally work. It's like you have kind of accomplished the initial goal you thought you needed to do. And then in so doing, have discovered there's actually, like, this... It pivots to another goal that goes above and beyond that one.
Like, in Mad Max Fury Road, they get to the green place, but it's a desert now, so they have superficially fulfilled their goal, but they have no inner fulfillment, so they have to go back and, like, take the capital.
100%. That's, like, that's normally how this kind of story would be structured if it's a movie. And this, like... I want to play it again to see how much of that is, like, are they going for something different that I just didn't pick up on? Or is it just, like, is it something of, like, it kind of got clunky near the end, they didn't know quite how to put these pieces together? I'm curious to, like, how I would experience that on a second playthrough.
Because it is weird. It does not have a clear rising action curve so much, because the last, like, I would estimate, like, 8 hours are, like, constant rising action. Like, there are so many insane things that happen near the end of this game, like the trip to Helheim, and the second trip to Helheim, and all the stuff with the multiple fights with Baldur, and the thing where you go into Jormungandr, the snake, and then everything that happens after that. And I was actually pretty constantly unsure how close I was to the end. Like, once you got to the end, he's like climbing the mountain. I'm like, I'm pretty sure we're near the end. It would be weird if they once again like took it away from us.
This like Baldur fucking climbs up from the other side. He thought I was dead, motherfucker. It's like, God damn it, Baldur.
Yeah. So, but again, so it's a very weird structure, but I liked it. And I think part of that is, and what was surprising to me is how resolutely the game stuck to its guns on what the actual scope of this story was for its characters.
Yes, yeah.
And I guess that's one of the things I was just... I think I was just naturally expecting that this was going to end with a fight with Odin or something. Like something much bigger was going to happen, and that the final scene is probably you scattering the ashes. But, like, to get there, you're going to have to, like, get embroiled in a godly war or something. Because it kind of felt like that's what's this building up to. And... no, there is a big fight near the end, but all it really is about is this little family drama with you, Baldur, and Freya. And I think there's some clunky things to talk about there. Like, I think the revelation that Freya is Baldur's mother comes way too late to give her that proper motivation, but we can talk about that later.
Yeah.
But I think all of that plays very well, and what it ultimately is about is a thematic resonance for Kratos as he has this final thing to tell his son. And once he has... and so the real arc of the game is a series of unburdenings, right?
Yeah.
What the real forward action is, and the pivots in, like, act structure, to me are more about the moments, and there's three primary ones where Kratos comes clean and tells his son what he needs to tell him. And once he has told him the big thing, that I killed my father, Zeus, I killed the whole pantheon, you know? Yeah. I killed them all.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. Because you have unburdened yourself, then you can go to the mountain and have that final scene, and it's beautiful. And that is where they choose to stick to their guns, and the ending is just a father and son, crazy father and son, but a father and son scattering wife/mother's ashes. That moved me unexpectedly powerfully, I think, because they never let the scale escape that.
Yeah.
And so when it happens, even though Kratos is a crazy fucking character, you know, and Atreus is apparently Loki and all that, we'll get into that. Just the simple act of a game that culminated in it, like all the things I did culminated in this tremendously human moment of scattering ashes, which I have done. Did that for my father on a lake in Canada. And so there's a lot of empathy there for me too. It felt very real. I think the control of scale in this game is commendable. And I do think it leads to some clunkiness. Like, inevitably, a lot of the game winds up feeling more like sequel bait than I think it probably wants to, because that's just not the scale this is operating on. But I'd also be curious to play it again and see how it all settles for me. Because ultimately, I really do like where the game goes, and that it never gets bigger than the emotions that drive it.
Yeah, I 100% agree with everything you said. That it is, and it is particularly that final scene and everything that... I mean, for me, what, as someone who played God of War 1, 2, and 3, the most utterly astounding thing about this game is how they realize Kratos as a character and make him both, to me, like, very recognizably the character I played as in those first three games, but is in such a different stage of his life and is dealing with such more understandable, relatable, like, human problems, but that also stems so much from his history as a person, as both a Spartan and, you know, this god of war who did some real fucking rough shit. Like, Kratos is not a good person. Kratos has never been a good person, and he kind of only got worse. I mean, he got a lot worse over the course of those three games. And so seeing him having to deal with those issues while also trying to find a way to raise a son in a way, and this is something like I kept on realizing more and more over the course of the game, and kind of like trying to understand Kratos' psychology, how much his own history of being a Spartan, which is a fairly significant thing in God of War 1, the like original God of War 1, affects himself of like, how the fuck is he going to raise this kid when the way that he was raised was the way that like Spartans were raised? It's like, you are part of this military unit. Like, you are not shown any love or affection. Like, you are 100% objective driven. You are like, you are a weapon that is aimed in a certain direction, told to do a certain thing, and you do that thing in the most efficient way possible. That's the only thing Kratos has ever known his whole life. And so now he's saddled with trying to raise this kid on his own. Is such a monumental task for someone that has that kind of history. And I find like that journey so interesting.
And, you know, when I talk about like that series of unburdenings, you know, like some of them are sort of forced, right? Like the first time he turns and says, I am from a far off land.
Yeah.
I am, you know, and they plays the God of War thing and it's just chills down the spine, right? And that one's very, very powerful. But I think the one that, there are two moments in this game that kind of broke me. The one I talked about at the end of the game, scattering the ashes. But the other one, because it is so unforced from Kratos, it is something he does not have to say in that moment, but he feels he has to say, is when Atreus has lost his mother's knife. And so Kratos said, when you were born, I made two knives.
Yeah.
And it's the two knives speech, and he gives it to him. And it ends, and this is in the period where Atreus is having his, like, ego episode, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, Kratos, you know, clutches his hands and gives him the knife and says, you have to be better than me.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the Kratos equivalent of breaking down, sobbing, hysterics, right?
Yeah.
Because he is literally saying something from the depths of his soul in the only way he knows how. And because Kratos has been, you know, established for us as this very curt, to-the-point character, he does not use more words than he needs to, as we have hilariously in all the episodes where he and Atreus are on the boat, and he'll tell him a story.
Yeah, he's telling him, like, Aesop's fables. Yep. It's, like, the most just nothing version of all those stories.
It's great. But that moment where he explains, like, why he made the knives and what he wants for his son, and that, and something that I think always there in Kratos in this game, from the beginning to the end. I think he does want that for his son, and the journey of discovery is how he might have to manifest it and what that demands of him truly, you know, to actualize that desire. You know, what it means in that moment. And that it also, it doesn't necessarily hit Atreus there. It's like a slow time bomb for Atreus of what those words mean. But we get it in that moment because it's something Kratos has needed, wanted, you know, had to say for a while. And there's moments like that where I think this game approaches, you know, Naughty Dog levels of quality of character writing and animation and performance that, as we've said before, I think very, very, very few developers the world over in this kind of real-time 3D game can do. And this game is totally on that level in a lot of those Kratos Atreus interactions. And I'm saying this as someone who knows nothing about the first three games.
Yeah.
Never played them, know a little bit of the story in the broad strokes, but, you know, more as mythology than as something I experienced, right? You know, I don't know Kratos' original voice or anything like that. And I came out of this, I tweeted this, I think Kratos, in this game at least, is one of the best character creations I've ever seen in a video game. I was more invested in him by the end of this game than I am in most characters by the end of most games. It is, I think, a truly remarkable character creation. And weirdly, I think it's something that works equally well, but in totally different ways, if you have zero God of War experience, then if you have all the God of War experience.
Yeah.
Because the journey of discovery of, like, only knowing some things about Kratos, or maybe if you play, you don't know anything about Kratos, I think the story can still 100% work. Just on a different level, where maybe you're seeing it through Atreus' eyes a little more. But that's a magic trick. That is a creative magic trick to be able to do that.
Yeah, and it's one of the great, like, elements of the writing for Kratos is that the history of that character doesn't feel like it is this like burden on the writing. It feels like it's this gold mine of like you have this wealth of history that this character, like, love or hate Kratos in the old God of War games, I think there's good reasons to do both. He is a character that has this, like, charismatic, iconic element to him. Like, it's always been something of, like, I think he's a, like, villainous monster in those games. But his performance and his character design and the, like, hyper-violent Greek mythological world he's set in makes him this character that, like, that when they did the reveal for this game in 2016 and he steps out from the shadows, it like aroused an emotion in me I didn't even realize I had towards God of War, which was a franchise I enjoyed but did not grow up with, or like I came to those games like way later. I came to those games like 2012 or 2013. But when Kratos steps out from the shadows and like the music plays, it's like, fuck, it's Kratos. He's the God of War. Like, he has this mythological presence to him. And I feel like in this game, they use that so well. In the, like you were saying, that even if you don't know anything about the old games and have no knowledge of it at all, you can feel the weight behind this character. You can understand and sort of intuit, this guy's been through some insane shit. And like, he has so much just madness bottled up inside him, you know, that you have to like slowly unspool little by little by little, because he doesn't understand himself. Like, he doesn't understand what he feels, and he certainly doesn't understand how to express his feelings in any way other than basically through violence.
Yes. And, you know, there's been increasing levels of debate online, I guess, about this game and, you know, what it has to say and whether it says it in the right way or not and what it doesn't say in some ways. And I don't... It's an interesting thing because I do think a lot of those conversations are going off of bringing in a lot of stuff from the first three games.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I guess I don't know how to fully engage with that because I haven't played them, and I think the game should be able to work without that weight of history, but it also does invite the weight of history, so I understand why people have had those reactions of, like, maybe thinking Kratos is let off the hook a little too easily or something. But I don't know. I also, to me, just from my perspective of, yeah, like, entering this as my first God of War game, there is something about, as awful as the stuff we come to learn in this game, and if you go, like, read the Wikipedia pages Kratos has done in the other games, is it carries less a literal weight to me than a mythological weight of, like, it's so heightened. And, mm-hmm, and this game follows that, too, even though it's a much more grounded setting, I take it, than maybe some of the Greek mythological,
oh, yeah,
stuff.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, but it does seem more like it is a mythological thing carrying into this game than a reality, like, yeah, obviously, if someone has killed 100 people, no, you probably don't want to forgive them, but that's not exactly what we're doing here. Like, this isn't a game about Hannibal Lecter. I don't know. It's a weird,
yeah,
thing.
Because it is one of those things of that the Kratos character was so made in the mold of Hercules who murders his wife and daughter in, like, a, yeah, blind rage because of the curse from Hera. So it's like, yeah, it is, he is very much, and that's always how I've interpreted God of War, like, and I feel like the people who took the much more, like, sort of literal, like, sort of interpretations of those characters felt misaligned to me. Of like, I agree with you, it has this big, crazy mythological weight to it, where it's like, you know, like in Norse myth, fucking the earth is made out of the flesh of Ymir, the giant that Odin and his two brothers like kill and scatter. Like the oceans are his blood and the clouds are his brains. It's like, that's not literal. Like, you're not supposed to, it's not like, oh, Odin has committed this treasonous act of violence against his father. It's like,
yeah,
I think like the scales of morality and ethics are not meant to be put on such a like literal scale in, yeah, the way it would be in a like more contemporary set game with more relatable human characters.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's not to say that's covering every complaint with the game. I'm not saying,
no,
that. It's,
yeah,
just, it's one thread I've heard. The other one is about, and I think this is an interesting one to get into a little bit,
okay, yeah,
Is some of the stuff around maybe gender in the game that I've heard talk about.
Yeah.
In that, obviously, I don't think anyone's going to argue that the original God of Wars are probably pretty problematic when it comes to some gender stuff,
oh, yeah,
especially sexuality, in that they infamously have like the sex minigame that I think we look at now and say that's in pretty poor taste.
Yeah, and it's just, it's something you look at now, and you're like, what the fuck were we doing in the mid? Because it was like, remember, this was contemporary with like the hot coffee mod and all that shit. Yeah.
Yeah. And that, you know, I think a lot of people said, well, yes, you know, God of War 2018 makes an obvious effort to grow up in that sense. It's a much more mature game in a lot of different ways. But it doesn't, like, so it doesn't have sex minigames, but also, like, you know, you never meet the mother character, and you never hear her voice, and you never really, you don't have to grapple with, like, maybe the misogyny side of it. And again, I can't really talk to Kratos' history with women because I don't know it. I will say, I think perspective is an interesting thing to talk about.
Yeah.
Because no one game can be all things to all people. And I do think one of the issues that you see is that, you know, game developers at this point in time for the big AAA stuff are a pretty homogenous bunch.
Oh, yeah.
And game critics are a pretty homogenous bunch. And so, yes, there is an issue of a lot of the people who worked on God of War and are reviewing God of War are sort of typically white men who have some, you know, similar backgrounds. A lot of, you know, critics who were reviewing the God of Wars made by Corey Barlog back in the day are, like Corey Barlog, now fathers and dealing with these same things. And so that's
the datification of video games is not just the video games, it's everything.
But I do think, like, through the specific lens of this is a game made by, you know, the director is someone who is a guy who has a kid and is thinking about fatherhood, and I'm sure a lot of the other people at on the team at Santa Monica Studio are in that, something like that boat.
Mm-hmm.
I think it does a, and we'll get into this more, I think it does a tremendous job exploring those ideas, and a beautiful job, and, you know, absence is a thing that happens in life, and I think it's, I think the way they handle the absence of the mother, and that it is a genuine absence, we don't cut it, because we have no cutaways, you know, we have no cuts, we don't go into memory, we don't see all of that, and I think there is an emotional truth to what it allows the characters to have, in that that absence is just felt in where it is, instead of having to illustrate it for us with showing her in some way, which I don't, you know, it's a different thing when you get into that, I guess is what I'm saying. And, you know, I've long said, I think this is true, you know, oftentimes with these kinds of trends, the problem is not necessarily an individual game. It sometimes is, often is. It's that, you know, we don't have the equivalent of middle-aged women who made games in their 20s getting to now make games in their 30s or 40s and see what that would be. And that's an obvious absence in the video game industry that would help alleviate something like a God of War feeling like it is coming from a pretty monolithic point of view. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think God of War, this game, to me, chooses and has a real, what feels like to me, honest point of view and heartfelt point of view, and follows it very well. And I also, I wouldn't want to take that away from the game. And I'm not saying including other perspectives would necessarily take it away, but I have heard, like, some of the things I've said of, like, things people think this game is missing to me sound like requests for a fundamentally different game.
Yeah, I'm mostly of the same opinion.
And I don't know if I'm saying that well, but
yeah, no, because it's something where if people want to see, like, some of the criticism we're talking about, a really good source is the Waypoint, the website Waypoint did. They both have a couple of articles, but mostly it's a podcast they did that I listened to that's like their God of War spoiler cast. So if you go on to Waypoint, you can find that. And that's where they talk a lot about these issues. And they go more on the side of they wish that Lafayette Faye, the mother, was more embodied in the game, given a voice and a presence. And I can understand that argument. But I'm kind of like, I mostly agree with you, Jonathan, that it feels to me like it's less of an issue with God of War and more of an issue that There's no mom game, you know? Like the closest you get to a big AAA action exclusive video game with a female protagonist is like you have Horizon Zero Dawn, which is still not made by a woman. Like that the design director of that game wasn't a woman, and it's also not like dealing with themes of motherhood and that kind of stuff. And I think that for God of War, the choice of having Faye be this like be absent but also hang over everything in the game so much, like this kind of omnipresent way that to me feels like it is the like reflection of what they did, of how Odin exists in this game, that Odin never manifests in any way. Odin never even like does something concretely. Like Thor is kind of throwing down lightning when you kill one of his sons and Thor gets pissed, but Odin doesn't do anything. But you hear all these stories about Odin and what Odin has done, and you get the sense of his power and how he hangs over this world. And for Kratos and Atreus, I feel like that's what Faye is. It's that she is this presence that hangs over both of them, and they're trading stories back and forth. Like, some of my favorite parts early on in the game are when Kratos is kind of telling Atreus a little bit about who Faye was before Atreus was born, and that she was this warrior, and that the dwarves made that axe for her so that she could avenge her people, because who were betrayed by the gods, which is all stuff that then you get contextualized later of, oh, fuck, she was a giant, she was part of the Jotun, and, like, all that kind of stuff. But, yeah, I feel like the way they handle Faye's presence in the game works for me for this game, but I 100% understand the criticism, and agree with the criticism that there needs to be, like, those sorts of, like, more feminine perspectives, exploring that kind of perspective. There needs to be games that are doing that alongside God of War, doing what it's doing with masculinity.
And that's not to say that future games in this series can't do that more. Yeah. And I guess the last thing I'll say on that topic specifically is this. The choice not to include more of Faye, the mother character, feels like a choice to me. It does not feel like an oversight out of, like, we didn't think about it. It honestly does feel like it was chosen that this has to be an absence, because when you have moments like when you're rowing your boat and just, you know, Atreus will say in kind of a soft voice something about his mother, and Kratos will try to say something back, and his voice is still stern, but it betrays some kind of sadness. That feels so tremendously humanizing to me, of that this is someone they have lost, and that loss is felt in us not seeing it and sensing it. And it's a whole part of this game's aesthetic of that this game happens in its immediate moment. It does not go forward. It does not go backward. It stays in the moment, and it never cuts. And you are with those characters on that, you know, this psychological and physical journey. And I think some of these things come out of that, in that, actually, there's a lot of stuff near the end where the game hints at a lot of narrative directions it never takes. And maybe that's a setup for sequels. I don't know. But it's ultimately choosing to tell this one fairly small-scale story in that. And I think that's part of it to me, too. And again, it's all, I think the game chooses its emotional and thematic scale pretty well. And I do have criticisms, and we'll get to those. Maybe just not that criticism.
Yeah. One thing, like, staying on the gender stuff for a little bit, one thing I do think that's interesting about this game that I kind of appreciate about it, and while we're in this mode of the datification of video games, where we have all these older game designers that are now our fathers and making games about fatherhood, is and I think one of the reasons why it feels very cute that this game doesn't have a very, like, feminine presence or feminine side, like, the only female character is Freya. But, like, one of the reasons why that is that way is that this is, like, the only dad game I can think of that's about a father-son relationship.
Yeah.
Like, all the other ones, like Last of Us, Bioshock Infinite, or if you go outside of games to, like, Logan, also very much feels like this. It is the father, like, gruff, military, emotionally shut-off father with the, like, kind of spunky, energetic, but also, like, vaguely masculine or tomboyish daughter relationship. Like, that's so the mode we've been in for a long time now with these kinds of narratives, and there is something that feels fresh about like, oh fuck, right? Like, it's not just dads and daughters. There's such a vastly different dynamic between a father and a son, which is something I don't know I would have quite realized about this game until I played it, like, how different that dynamic, like, different this relationship dynamic feels to me compared to Joel and Ellie in The Last
of Us. Oh, sure. I mean, there is a weird cognitive dissonance for me in the early hours where it took me a while to warm to Atreus at all, and I have some issues with his characterization, but we can get to that later. But, like, in the beginning, it's because this is working in a mode that we're super familiar with, like you said, Last of Us, Bioshock Infinite, Logan, what have you. There's a million of them. But it is a father-son thing, and, you know, the son is just a normal little kid. They're not in, like, a post-apocalyptic thing either, you know, so you don't have that, which is often thrown onto these, because when you have the father-daughter thing and those other things we're talking about, you're often also doing an exploration of gender roles, like, opposing gender roles in those ways, too, which this game is, gender roles is an important part to it, but more on the masculinity side of things, you know, and I think part and parcel with that, too, is that we have a lot of portrayals of masculinity in American pop culture, in American mass media, without, I think, a lot of introspection about masculinity, because I think those are two different things.
Oh, yes.
I think you can portray masculinity, and you can think critically about masculinity, and I think sometimes those go together, but the vast majority of the time, they do not, you know? And so I think something like God of War is really valuable in, I think, asking some key questions about masculinity and violent or angry or unhealthy masculine tendencies in a way that, you know, a lot of properties you would pay lip service to it, but I don't think you would do the legwork on it.
Yeah, or like I feel like it's a problematic storytelling dynamic. Like another way is this urge to do the the male father figure kind of like makes the female daughter figure like and kind of pulls her into like the masculine, powerful, strong, stoic side of the scale, while the daughter pulls the stoic, masculine, strong male figure to the like emotional and empathetic side of like the female side of the scale.
That's the bad version of this.
Yeah, and that like is the dynamic though. That is basically how The Last of Us works. That is basically how Logan works. Like, and I'm not saying like that makes those stories bad. Certainly, I'm not saying that. But I feel like there is a certain storytelling crutch that is being used there that is making assumptions about gender and is using gender in this like very conventional social symbolic kind of way to communicate those character shifts to you in a way that it, like the mass, like the mainstream audience is going to like immediately understand. And there's something interesting and compelling to me about the idea of saying, what if instead of that being a daughter, it's a son? And then I also want to see the mother and daughter version of that, and the mother and son version of that, obviously.
Well, because how often do you think this is someone wanting to maybe tell a story about a father and son and thinking it should be different genders and then channeling kind of thoughts on sonhood, whatever you want to call that, into a daughter character?
Yeah.
I think you see, I would not say that about like The Last of Us or something, but I'm forgetting what example I'm trying to think of here, but there are definitely times I think I've seen things like that where it feels like you wanted to tell a different story here, you know?
Yeah.
And it does feel honest to just have it be, again, the father and the son. And again, it's weird to say that is maybe an underexplored dynamic in our current pop culture moment, but it sort of weirdly is.
Yeah, because it's just a side of masculinity I think is not usually portrayed as particularly that like kind of son thing. Especially because it's Corey Barlog knows both sides of that experience. And we both know one side of that experience of being the son, but he's both been the son and is now the father, right? So there's a certain perspective I think comes along with that, that for me, it made me think about some things in my own past and like some of those scenes, own relationship with either my father or like other masculine, like role model figures I've had in my life. And there's like it gets at that stuff in a way, like, I don't think I realized how underserved that storytelling opportunity feels until it was explored in this game.
I think there's an assumption in a lot of fiction that, because you see this often, in that if you tell stories about parents and children, you often pair the parent with an opposite gendered kid.
Yeah.
Because I think there's an assumption that like, oh, that's the harder relationship. Which I don't know if that's true. I don't know. I don't have kids.
But I
guess when I think about it in my head, like if I had kids one day, far off, hopefully. But like if I have kids one day, I would be much less worried about having and raising a daughter than I would about having and raising a son.
I 100% am with you. Like, the idea of raising a son fucking terrifies me.
Because I feel like I would have some objectivity in raising an opposite, I shouldn't even say gendered, of the opposite sex, you know? Because gender is a social construct. But, you know, like, that's something of, like, I feel like I could take myself out of it slightly more weirdly because she would not have the exact same life experiences, whereas a son would be going through a lot of things that come with being a guy that I would know and would be scarier to deal with because the mirror is literally more like immediate. Even if that is a facile human failing of ours to read it that way, it just kind of feels true. And I actually think God of War, I can imagine the version of this where Kratos has a daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it would feel in some ways like the easier way out to having, because I think Kratos could avoid a lot of the questions he asks himself if he had a daughter, especially in a medieval kind of setting where generals would just also mean something different.
Because the main thing to me in this game of like Kratos's like path through this game, like alongside the unburdenings that you talked about, which I really like the way you phrase that, but it's with the unburdenings, it's also this fear he has and the reason why he is so tied up with his own past and who he is and what he's done is that he's so afraid of making Atreus like himself.
Yes.
Which is not a fear I think you'd like. And I think, like, when I think about, like, hypothetically having a son, like, I think that's part of the reasons why, like, that scares me so much more than having a daughter, is because there feels like there's a certain distance of, like, it would be harder to turn a daughter into me. It would be way easier to fuck up a son to be fucked up in the exact way, same ways that I'm fucked up, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think, like, that fear of, like, looking at yourself in the mirror in this younger version of yourself, this son you have, like, that is so much of what Kratos deals with in this game.
Absolutely. Atreus is a really interesting character.
Yeah.
Because part of it is that, again, there's the gender-sex dynamic going on here, right? But there is also, to me, like, he's just kind of written inherently differently than a lot of kids in these pieces of media lately. Like, if you think about, like, the 2013 duo of Bioshock Infinite and Last of Us,
yeah.
where I always think of Elizabeth and Ellie kind of in... They're Elizabeth, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
because you could have also called her Ellie. Anyway. But Elizabeth and Ellie, because they are weirdly such similar characters, too, in that they are super intelligent and spunky, and they have some tomboyish qualities, but also, like, they're very nihilistic in a lot of ways because of the way they've been raised and what's happened to them in the world, but have, like, this inherent curiosity. They're kind of larger-than-life characters in both cases.
Yeah.
Like, they are the flashier character of the main two in both games, right?
Oh, yeah.
And they don't do that at all with Atreus. It's a really interesting thing, and it took me a while to get used to this and figure out how I felt about it. Atreus is just written like a normal kid and performed like a normal... He sounds like a kid from Texas. Like, he just sounds
I assume his voice actor is, just a boy.
Yeah, no, I think he's just, like, a 10-year-old kid. And, like, they're not having him do any kind of accent to make it sound more like he's in this Norse mythological setting. They have not written him to sound like he was raised in this Norse mythological setting. I think there is a little cognitive dissonance of that to me at least the early outset, because Kratos is so much stylized and Atreus is so much not. But I think the further you get into the game, you realize the value of that, because I think it's intentionally disarming that this kid is just a kid. He is pretty tabula rasa. He is pretty blank in a lot of ways, and he's a sponge soaking things up, you know, and he can be excited about things, and he wants to go explore on the lake, and it's the best excuse for side quests ever in terms of narrativizing, that one of them on his life does not want to do side quests, and the other one is a little kid who is fucking curious about it, and of course the curiosity wins out, because that's how it goes. And there's even a topic to be had there about how the game separates kind of player motivation across two characters, which is interesting, but I feel like that's a different theoretical discussion. But I do think when push comes to shove and Atreus starts being a more active part of the storytelling, I think it pays off making him just so much a kid, like a 2018 child in at least voice and mannerisms, you know. He's not like going around saying like everything's chill or something. That'd be weird.
He's not sitting there playing fucking Fortnite Mobile on his smartphone.
Yes, he's not doing the teenage Groot thing.
What are you doing, boy? Playing Fortnite, Dad. Stop that, boy. We need to slay these Draugr.
But at the same time, he can be kind of flippant in the way a kid is flippant. He can be, you know, as I said, excited or downtrodden. And again, when he is brought into a more active role into the story, I do think there's a payoff there. And having the heightened presence of Kratos and then the anchor being such a recognizable kid who does not feel plucked from mythology at all. The way literally every other character, of which there's only like six voiced characters in this game, every other character feels plucked from mythology and Atreus doesn't. And I think that gives the game something of an emotional buy-in, but also an emotional request to the player to come along with them on that level of emotional realism that is a super interesting choice. And I bet if we were like asking Corey Barlog about this, I assume this was a debate within the studio of like, what kind of kid is Atreus? And coming down on he's just going to be a kid, I think is an interesting choice and not probably your first thought on what this kid would be.
Yes. This just in, it is a child. It's Sonny Suljic, who is, as your Wikipedia article will tell you, is an American child actor and skateboarder.
Okay.
He skateboards as well.
I can imagine Atreus on a skateboard with that voice.
100%. And I think for me, it's one of the things that distinguishes Atreus among like all the other child characters, both him being a son, but it's also he doesn't have that thing that, again, going to like Elizabeth or Ellie or like X-23 and Logan or like all those characters. All those characters also have like what you said, that sort of like nihilism or just this world weariness. You know, it's like, I've fucking been through the zombie apocalypse, man, and I fucking murdered my best friend, and I did all this bullshit, and it's like, that's so a part of it. Or like another game, The Walking Dead with
sure, Lee, that's the other one I think we've been thinking about.
Yes, because that's also from that like 2012, 2013, the like kernel of the seed that sprouted into the datification of video games we're still living in today. It's like all of those games have that like, oh, like this kid has seen all this shit, and is like more mature than some of the adults you encounter because they've like grown up too fast in a world that doesn't want them or something. You know, it's like that kind of dynamic. Atreus doesn't have that at all. Like, Atreus is just this kid who's, like, naturally curious and fun-loving. It's like, he's sad because his mom died, but it's not like he had to, like, cut off his mom's head because she was about to murder him. You know, it's not this, like incredibly tragic backstory. It's a normal, like, his mom just died because she was sick or something. Like, we never even really find out what kills her. It's like, it's just a normal thing that happens.
And I can easily imagine the version of this game where there's the third act revelation of he had to kill his mom or something, right? Yeah. And like, that fucked him up really bad. But they don't, yeah, they really avoid some of the, I don't know, some of the soapier things they could have done here,
yeah, weirdly. And it's the thing that makes him feel, as you said, he just feels like a kid who like, loves his dad, but is afraid of his dad, wants to spend time with his dad, and wants to be recognized and acknowledged by his father, but is also kind of afraid of all of those things as well, and is, like, it just feels like he's constantly, like, bouncing off against the, like, rock slab that is Kratos, trying to find some way in, and, like, so he goes through the modes of being, like, yes, sir, like, and being very respectful, and then he, like, goes through his big rebellious phase where it's, like, no, we're both gods, and it's, like, you know, he's constantly trying to find some angle to attack Kratos at to get him to get Kratos to acknowledge Atreus in the way that Atreus wants to be acknowledged, but he can never quite find that until, like, the very end of the game when Kratos finally, like, lets his bullshit down.
And I think there's something super universal that comes across in the idea of the child grappling with a parent's past that they don't know.
Oh, yeah.
Because all kids deal with that, and all parents deal with that. And this game, as you said earlier, really is about the two sides of the mirror, being a parent and being a kid, and that if you grow old enough and you have a kid, you have been both, you know, for most people. And
it'd be impressive if you hadn't.
If you hadn't. Well, I'm saying there are people who maybe grow up without their literal parents, but then you still have a parental figure, yes, probably in most cases.
You still were a child. We're still a child, before, yes, you became an adult. Is, yeah, an assertion I feel pretty strong about.
Some people might have amnesia, but, you know.
Sure. I don't know if that quite works in the soap opera way you're imagining.
No, it does not.
It's not like season one of 24.
That's a deep cut.
It's one you, I will never forget.
For all you 24 heads out there. No, but and there is this potent metaphor in the game with this, in that Kratos, his lost past that the son doesn't know about, some players know about in excruciating detail because they played a trilogy of games about it.
Yeah.
Or another seven PSP games about it.
Yes, two PSP,
right,
games and God of War Ascension, the game that time forgot.
I think there's also a mobile game.
Every game had a mobile game in the late 2000s.
Yes, because I was reading on Wikipedia, it says God of War is the eighth entry in the God of War franchise. I'm like, where'd you get that count? And I had to look it up. But anyway, I'm like, there are more God of War games than I thought.
Yeah.
But anywho, like, so there's that side of, like, literally his history is out there, and so we know what Kratos is trying to hide. Kind of, even if you haven't played those games, you probably know some of that history, right?
Yeah, but if you've been, like, tuned into video game culture at all in the past, like, decade plus,
And even if not, I think the way it works is still a potent metaphor.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Because that is just a thing of, like, there comes a point, and I'm sure you can speak to this too, as you're growing up, when you start to realize, like, oh, my parents had lives before me, right?
Yeah.
And that their life extends beyond mine in that direction, and that they had experiences that maybe I'll hear about, but I'll never really know, and I'll never really understand. And they were manifestly different people at some point than the people I knew, you know?
Yeah.
Just because people change and grow and evolve. And, like, you know, for me, when a parent passes away, too, you start to learn things about them that, you know, sometimes good, sometimes bad, but you just start to reckon with, like, the life of this person was bigger than just mine. And that is a fascinating existential thing to think about, and something I think this game grapples with really interestingly.
Yeah.
In that, you know, Atreus does want to know about his dad because he thinks something's up with him because he's got gray skin and he's super strong and all that. It'd be a little weird, you know? But even when he does start learning things, one of the things I like in Atreus' reactions to the different unburdenings is that it's not an answer for him. Like, the question of, like, why are you the way you are, Dad? He's never going to know that. Like, Kratos could sit there and tell him his life story in excruciating detail, and he still wouldn't quite know that because he didn't literally live that person's experience. And empathy with a parental figure is a really weird, hard thing to think about because we think we just have it.
Uh-huh.
And we do in some ways, but we don't in other ways. And so I like those moments where, like, you know, in the climactic scene when Kratos explains that I killed my father, Zeus, and all this stuff, and Atreus is like, oh, so what we saw in the realm was real and that. But he doesn't really have a reaction beyond that other than, it's good to know, but like, oh, you're still the same dad. Like, I still feel the same way about you. And that there's also that thing of like, no matter what we learn, I guess we could learn particularly terrible things, you know? Like, oh God, you were a serial killer? That'd be weird.
But like, I mean, the big bomb that still has not dropped is, by the way, I had an old family, yeah, and I kind of, it wasn't my fault. It wasn't my fault, but I did totally murder them, and then I was cursed by Athena, and their like ashes are grafted onto my skin, and that's why I'm pale, ghostly white. So it's like every time I hug this, there's a little bit of my old daughter rubbing off on your clothes.
This will get more complex with Atreus for, you know, aforementioned mythological reasons.
Yeah.
But within the confines of this game, I do like that thing of like, there are moments that maybe make you reevaluate your parents. But then at the end of the day, you realize, yeah, but my experience with them is the same, and it doesn't change the fundamental truth of what this thing is. And I know I'm extrapolating a lot here, but that's the thing that I think this game does well, is that it really doesn't come to concrete answers on any of its big thematic things.
Oh, yeah.
Like, there are no moments where, you know, Kratos soliloquies about what the moral of the story was. And I think that's good.
Well, other than the moments where he soliloquies about the morals of all the stories, because that's the only thing he tells you about the story is what the point was.
But this is not a clean, simple story being told, and I think a lot of it is just, again, because it's a big one-shot thing, nothing is necessarily completely, you know, brought to a place of closure at the end of this story, but you just observe what happens, and you think about it, and you meditate on it, and I think it gets at some very interesting human truths, but it asks you to engage with that rather than putting, like, clear punctuation points on everything, and that's pretty rare for a video game, for any piece of American mass media.
Yeah, and that reminds me of something I was going to mention earlier when we were talking about some of the criticisms of the game, and, like, one that I don't agree with is this, like, I think some people are taking it of, like, going back to the Kratos and, like, oh, it's, like, Kratos redeemed. Do we really need to tell a redemption story around Kratos? And that's something, whereas I feel like people are interpreting the story of this game way more cleanly than I feel it is of, like, you know, maybe wanted to start digging into some, like, the Freya-Baldur stuff. But when you kill Baldur, like, I don't think the game's telling you, like, that was just the right thing to do. Like, it's a big, for a lot of reasons, it's a big step that Kratos takes that, like, Kratos at the beginning of the game would not have done that. He would not have gone out of his way to kill Baldur. He would have let things be and, like, moved on with his life. So it's like, there is still a big, like, character, like, change and development that has happened with him to get him to that point. But I don't think that that's saying that what he did was the right thing to do. And, like, the game very, like, visually tells you that when he's kneeling down and, like, talking with Atreus. And I forget what the line is, but there's, like, this, like, dark comic irony to a line that is delivered about, like, and, like, we did it or something. And then Freya walks into the frame cradling Baldur's body with, like, tears streaming down her face. It's like, yeah, you did something. It's like, it's not just good. And I think there's, like, there's a lot of that in this game to me. It's, like, not a didactic story at all. It's not telling you that, like, you should be like Kratos. It's like, exploring these questions of fatherhood and sonhood, if that's a word. But it's not telling you, like, this is the way you should be with your life. It's like learn what lessons you can from seeing this journey that Kratos has gone on. But don't be like Kratos. Never be like Kratos. That's a bad mistake to make.
But it's not a game of absolutes either, because he's a really good father in parts of this story that I think is, you know, like, is he a gruff father? Yes. But he's often a really good one. Is he a shitty one sometimes? Yes, also. Yeah. Is he a good person in this game sometimes? He helps people sometimes, yeah. Is he a bad person in this game sometimes? Yeah, he's a dick sometimes. But, like, there is no easy point of resolution, and it is a kind of messy character. And I think the narrative is messy around him intentionally.
Yes.
And there are unintentional messiness things, too.
Yeah, in terms of the structure stuff. Yeah,
but, like, I think, though, there are intentional messinesses to it. And I think the Baldur thing is really key. Because I've been grappling with this, and I've been wanting to talk about it, because it's a hard thing to think about.
Yeah.
But also, the more I think about it, and the more I'm unable to figure out what the actual answer is to this scene, the more I think they made the right creative choice. Because, I mean, one, that whole sequence is just pretty stunning of, like, the long, long fight you're having with Baldur, and Freya is trying to get you to stop, and Kratos does, like, try to call it off at several points.
Kratos, like, this is one of the things about, like, where it's so, when you're talking about Kratos, it's very different than talking about almost any other character, because Kratos gives Baldur like three chances to stop. That's three more chances than Kratos has ever given anything ever in his whole fucking life.
Yes.
Like, Kratos would murder an innocent puppy if it would make it so he would be able to achieve his goal 1 second quicker than it otherwise would. Like, that's the guy he is. So it's like him telling Baldur, like, hey, you're on a path of revenge. This is a bad idea. I know it's a bad idea. You know it's a bad idea. Stop it.
Yeah.
The fact that he does that is like, holy shit, Baldur, you have no idea how fucking lucky you are. The fact that he does that like two more times.
Just within,
oh my god.
Just within the confines of this game, like meeting Kratos at the beginning to here, not even playing 1 through 3, it feels like a big thing, right? Yeah. And so, but you have this long fight, and it is so multi-layered, because it is Kratos fighting Baldur, primarily because Baldur is threatening his kid, you know?
Yeah.
And that, like, he has a fatherly duty here, and the one thing he's going to not do at this point is let Baldur rip his kid's head off or something, you know? But Freya is the mother who, and we'll talk about that because I think there's some messiness there, but we'll get into that in a second, who Baldur is her son who she does not want to see killed, and this is her tragic, in that kind of mythological way, that is her tragic flaw, is that she so does not want to see her son die that she has kind of doomed him to become the way he is.
Yeah.
And so she wants to stop the fight. But Baldur doesn't want to stop the fight because he blah, 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 you know. And so you have everyone kind of coming from different directions at it. And everyone is right and everyone is wrong. And it's just kind of a really wrenching sequence because you're playing it. You're beating the shit out of Baldur and you don't really want to do it. Like, you don't want to see that health bar go all the way down. You don't want to have to finish this. You hope something will happen in the middle. And you kind of realize, I think Kratos is maybe in that headspace too. And Freya is in this totally different headspace. And it's operating on this huge mythological scale. But what it comes down to is you finally get to this last scene and Baldur just, it becomes manifestly clear, will not stop. And who he ultimately wants to kill is Freya. And so Kratos snaps his neck.
Yeah.
And I have thought a lot about this in the week or so since I played that scene. Mm-hmm. Of like, what are other things they could have done? I mean, okay, the game could have ended with him killing Freya. The game could have ended with him killing Freya, Kratos, and Atreus or something. The game could have ended with some sort of like weird MacGuffin kind of thing where he gets his immortality back and leaves or something stupid like that. Which I feel like is the way a lot of these would end.
Yeah.
And then everything's like fine. You could do something where like Kratos does get through to him and explains, like, you don't want to become like me, and he tells the story and all that, but I don't think that would necessarily feel true to either character fully in what happened. So what we're left with is this very messy ending of where Kratos, as part of his unburdening, is where he explains, I killed my own father, and I hate that I had that rage. He doesn't say all these things literally, but that's what's being said between the lines there, right? And yet at the same time, he also kills this kid so the kid won't go on and kill the mother. And it's like, well, that's clearly not a perfect solution to this question, no. Kratos. But then you're asking yourself, creatively, you're writing the script, you've put yourself into this corner, what is the choice you make here to wrap this story up? And I guess you ask, does that feel like the honest thing as a storyteller that Kratos would do in that moment? Yes.
Yeah, and it's also like, it's the, not only is it the thing that like his character would do at that point, it's also, I feel like it's really resonant in the narrative for his character for a couple of reasons. Of like, you know, this is something that probably reads a little bit stronger if you played God of War, particularly 2 and 3, because 1 doesn't really deal with the Zeus stuff at all. But the Freya Baldur stuff mirrors the Kratos Zeus stuff. But now Kratos is on the other side of the equation, right? He's gone through what Baldur is about to attempt to do. Kratos understands how much of a mistake it is, and I think in Kratos' mind, it is both he believes it would be better, like one of these two people is going to die no matter what he does. Like, whether or not you believe that, Kratos believes that for sure. Because Kratos' only solution, like, if Kratos is going to engage in violence, he's going to kill somebody. Kratos is not going to engage in violence to stop somebody, he's going to kill them. Like, that's it. Like, if it comes to the point that he's going to fight somebody, he's going to kill them. He's a Spartan. There's no, like, middle measure there, you know? So it's like, one of these two people is going to die. For him, Freya is the person he would want to have live, not Baldur. I don't think the reasons need to be explained for that, right?
He even says that to Atreus on the boat after that, of like, the world is better with Freya in it.
Yes, and so he chooses that Freya should be the one to live, but then also, him killing Baldur is symbolic of him choosing this other path of destroying his past self. Of like owning up to, in his own way, the mistakes that he made means not letting Baldur make the exact same mistakes. And so it's like, the only way he can think of to do that is to kill him.
Yeah. No, and so yes, is it like a morally resonant choice? He has redeemed himself.
Oh no.
No, but in the weird like mindset of Kratos and where we are in the story, it does feel like a significant character progression. And I think that's a separate thing than redemption.
Because also he, again, I think I sort of talked about this earlier, he kills Baldur not because Baldur's like after them anymore. Like right. Because it becomes pretty clear he's beaten Baldur. What Baldur is interested, as you said, is killing Freya. Like that's his mission. And normally, like again, Kratos at the beginning of the game would have just walked away at that point. Because what does it matter to him? He steps in to save Freya's life specifically, which is not something, again, I have ever seen Kratos do. Ever. In three plus, like, almost the entirety of this game, I've never seen him, of his own will, not because Atreus tells him to, not because anything else, like he just steps in to somebody else's affair and save someone's life in the only way he knew how to. That's, like, a huge character change for Kratos for me.
Yeah, and I do think what you said there, the idea of him killing this like symbol of his past self, is really symbolically resonant to me.
Yeah.
Because it is just that image of him snapping the neck of this guy who, in some ways, is more like Kratos was in the past than Kratos is now. Is consumed with rage and vengeance. And then what happens after that with kind of the final unburdening, the thing with the wraps around his arms, which we'll get to. Just, it is a really symbolically resonant image. And I don't know. I do think a lot of analysis these days comes down to how cleanly can we pull an idea or a reading out of a moment.
Yeah, there's like a didactic sort of need of like, this needs to teach you a lesson or something.
And it's not always a bad thing. I just think it's the mode criticism is in right now, especially on the internet.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't tend to go in that direction. I like the ambiguities and I like the spaces where you cannot draw a single clear moral conclusion from something. You know, I think there's a lot of like directors I love and study who would not have a career if we lived in this didactic era of interpretation. And I think that is one of those moments and things in this game that everything that kind of comes with it is one of those things that just feels like it is very much a rejection of any kind of didacticism and makes for interesting debate, you know, with yourself, with the game, with others, this sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I want to say I like Freya as a character a lot in this game. I think she's really interesting. I love every scene with her. She tends to like kind of be a nice injection of energy into the story whenever she comes back, because it feels like, you know, we've been with like maybe the same characters for a while and she kind of gives us a different chemistry. I do think it does feel kind of like they decided she is Baldur's mother like 3/4 of the way into writing the game and did not go back and seed that properly to me, because that feels like, you know, maybe the specific revelation of like this is her son is something you could hold off on. But that, I think maybe she mentions she has a child earlier.
It definitely, because like some of her conversations with Kratos, like it becomes very clear the reason why she is so attached to Atreus is because she has a child.
Yeah, but I don't know. I think it's because there are so many revelations doled out about Freya in that you first meet her and she's got an interest in animals. Oh, but she's actually a witch. Oh, but she's a witch who can do these. Oh, but she's actually Odin's fucking wife, Freya.
Yeah.
And like, there's just so many levels of that that by the time you get to it with Baldur and then it becomes this all-consuming character motivation at the end, I don't know how I would write it differently. I just know that I think there's ways to make it slightly cleaner, because it does feel like the character makes a pretty rapid shift in her final scenes that could have been seeded better.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think like, I'm fine with Freya being Baldur's mother, because like if you want to get into the mythology stuff there, it's like it's a bit messy in that in the original mythology it's more this goddess called Frigg, but it's also there's all this like scholarly debate over whether or not Frigg and Freya are actually the same goddess and all this, like it's all horseshit. But yeah, like there's so that some kind of stuff feels a bit messy, and I agree with you, there's just something like you needed to more directly seed this at some point early on. And I wonder if that is also because of the like one-shotness of it makes it like hard to do that.
Yeah.
Because also like the way that you find out that Baldur is Freya's son is like, I think it ultimately pans out pretty well the way they execute on it, but it's a pretty like belabored way to get to reveal that information of like, you're both trapped in Helheim and you're climbing up this thing and you overhear him like with his, like this vision of that he's seeing that is torturing him in hell. Like it works fine in the game's execution, but it's the kind of thing that like, any other story would not have to do this. Any other story would just cut away and, like, reveal that information, like, in a much more convenient manner.
Yes, and a lot of it relies on Mimir, who I love as a character. Mimir is fucking awesome. Yeah. But having to, like, do a lot of exposition lifting that feels like this was an inconvenient thing to have to dole out, so we gave it to the head.
Yeah.
You know? And most of the time that works, because I think video games are one of those mediums where it is totally okay to have an exposition dump character. You can do that, and it can work.
Especially when that exposition dumb character is literally a talking head on your belt.
Yes, no, that's... The game is very self-aware of it, and it's funny. But yeah, I think that's a little messy. I don't think, like, they sell Freya out. I think she's an interesting character. You know, I do think clearly also there's a lot where they are laying down a lot of track that I assume they're going to ride on later, because... I would be fine if they never made another one of these. I think this is a very satisfying story on its own, but it does also feel like in 10 years we're going to look back and this is part one of three, and it's very clearly a trilogy.
Yeah, that's what it feels like to me.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
So, and we can talk about that more later, speculation of where they might go next. I assume Freya will be a big part of that. And I hope they're able to, like, find a way to kind of even out the different parts of her character in future appearances. Because she does feel like a slightly schizophrenic character by the end of this.
Yeah.
In terms of just, she's been a couple different people over the narrative.
The thing I'm really interested to see with Freya is what her relationship with Atreus is going to be like. Because she fucking hates Kratos. Like, I get it. Like, that's what it's going to be. But it's like, you know, how does she respond and react to Atreus at this point? I think that'll be an interesting thing to see with that character going forward.
Really interesting, because that's part of, like, Kratos' choice in killing Baldur that feels very true to him, is that he doesn't care if she's going to hate him. He knows she's going to hate him, but he thinks it's for the better, and he doesn't need people to like him. He really doesn't.
He's never cared about that ever.
I think he'd prefer at this point if Atreus likes him. Other than that, I don't think he really cares.
Yes, yeah.
You know. It's weird. So we've talked a lot about most of the main characters here. As I said, there's not that many voiced characters in the game.
Yeah, the only ones we've kind of talked a little bit about Mimir, and then the only other ones are Brock and Sindri, I think, right?
Brock, Sindri, and then the two Thor sons.
Oh, right, yeah, Magni and Modi.
Yeah, and then you have some random people out in the world, like the ghosts and stuff.
Sure, yeah, but the SideQuest people.
Yeah. It is. I guess I do have a question of, is this world uninhabited, or are we just in an area that has no people in it? Because it does seem to go back and forth a little bit on what, and I don't really care. It's video game logic. I can live with a lot of this stuff. It is such a kind of barren world in terms of, like, inhabitants. And I don't know if we're just in the end times or if they're somewhere else.
I think it's probably both of those things that feels to me like Kratos and Faye, like, intentionally are living in this, like, totally deserted area.
Yeah.
You know, in this, like, forest in the middle of fucking nowhere. Like, the most you see of any, like, you have that one scene early on where Atreus kills that one guy, that, like, right before they turn into Hellwalkers or whatever. And then around that section, you see some, like, other burned villages.
Yeah.
But other than that, yeah, there are no other human settlements in this area, which feels to me like, with it being, like, Tyr's Temple and, like, all these, like, dragons and all this shit, like, it's clearly some, like, this big nexus for the more, like, powerful mythical beings in this world, that there are not a lot of normal humans hanging around. But there's also definitely, like, you're on the, like, verge of Ragnarok beginning, which is, like, there's an apocalyptic thing hanging over the proceedings of this game that, like, then proved, like, very much true when Baldur is killed, which is one of, like, the first things that start leading you to Ragnarok in the mythology.
Yeah. So, very interesting stuff with that. But let's talk about these other characters. So, you've got the Thor sons. Not much to say about them.
Yeah, the bosses halfway through the game.
Yes.
That, like, basically the role they fulfill.
I do like those boss fights.
Yes, I like those boss fights. I like the what they do with the one that survives, and that they make, like, you know, they push Atreus to doing a thing that Kratos would have done.
Yeah.
That, like, in murdering Modi or whichever one it is, that's, like, it's a pretty intense scene that's kind of unpleasant. But
because Kratos wouldn't do it in that moment.
Yes, this Kratos would not do it.
Right.
Old Kratos would 100% would have done that.
But that's the interesting thing, right? Is that dynamic of, and that's what kind of leads him to say the thing about, you know, you need to be different. You need to be better than me.
Yeah.
All of that. It's
that I have taught you to fight in order to survive, which is something that, like, old Kratos, that's not why you fought.
No. So you have that. But then we have, Brock, Sindri, Mimir. Mimir's awesome. He's great from the moment he arrives to the end. I love Mimir, and You accept him so quickly into the game. Of like, yeah, I got a head on my belt. What are you talking about? Your game doesn't have a head on the belt?
Yeah.
Fuck off. But I remember I was playing the game and my brother walked into the room and he said, is that a head hanging on your belt? And I'm like, and I paused the game and I'm like, this is a spoiler. Like, just forget about it. You'll figure it out.
Yeah, I particularly love every time you get into the boat and you have to hand it to Atreus and like Atreus sets Mimir down next to him on the other like seat.
But it's just, I love that voice actor. It's just a great characterization, and you just feel like such a team by the end.
Yeah.
Of like, I think the Kratos who first meets Mimir, once he had finished his task, would have just left the head in a bucket somewhere. At the end, it feels like Kratos is happy to just let the head be with them for a while.
Kratos, his boy, and his head.
The head can do the talking. I also love that at no point in the game does Kratos ever call him Mimir. He is always head.
Yeah. I mean, also, just the first cutscene with Mimir is so good, and that, like, I think it's the moment where Mimir is, like, talking to Kratos, and is like, boy, you need to talk to your son, and, like, tell him this stuff, and, like, tell him about his past, and then he's like, pauses for a second, Kratos says, I'm going to cut off your head now.
That's
really fucking funny.
All of that is wild, and I love it, and because I did not know where they were going with that at first, you know, you take this fucking dead head, and I assumed like something else was going to happen with the head. So when you have it on like your belt before it's reanimated, I'm like, that's kind of cool that they went to the trouble of animating this dead head for this quest.
I had the exact same thought of like, oh, that's like in a normal video game, this would have just gone to your like backpack or something and never seen it. Now they put it on your belt. That's really awesome. Like right, like with your Bifrost thing and everything. And then later it's like, oh no, because he's with you for like the whole game past this point.
It's weird. Like if I replayed the game, I'd be really weirded out at the beginning when you don't have a head on your belt.
Yeah, it's just Kratos and Atreus.
Yes. You know? All right. It's the one thing the Donkey Kong games are missing from earlier is that Donkey Kong doesn't carry Cranky's head on his belt.
Did I ever tell you the story about the Kremlin Kings and how they slaughtered the giants?
Yes. How they stole the banana horde?
Yeah.
No. Anyway, Mimir's great. Brock and Sindri, I'll say this. I don't like how they're introduced. I think the game spends way too much fucking time on them in the first, like, 3 hours of, like, you meet one, and he does the whole thing with the axe, and, like, they really labor the point of, like, these are going to be your blacksmith people. And then you meet the other one, and then you immediately meet the other one again for another. Like, there's too many scenes with them at the very beginning that feel like they're really trying to lay down legwork of, like, this is how the mechanics of the game work. Once they settle into being, like, just parts of the story and fixtures of the world, I got to really like them. And I think once you start doing their quests and, like, learning more about, like, who they are as characters, and especially by the end when they come back together to like build your fancy new whatever, it's just it was heartwarming and I liked that. And by the end, I loved Brock and Sindri.
Yeah, I like the way that they took this thing that in most video games is this very like minor mechanical, like there's like the blacksmith that you go and talk to and they like fix up your shit, and they incorporated it more fully into the game world, which is like a lot of I think the ethos of how they designed this game was like, how do we like incorporate this and make it feel like a seamless element of everything else that is going on. And yeah, and I just love the little bits of story and that like they are for the sort of latter half of the game your source of like side quests and stuff like that, and both of them have their own side quest threads that they kind of like come together and unify at the end. And like, yeah, they're just fun little characters. And I particularly love whenever they would intersect into the main story. Uh-huh. Like, particularly when you go to Helheim for the first time and Brock shows up and is like, hey, buddy, give me your Blades of Chaos and you can now harness the winds of hell. It's like, thanks, Brock. You're a cool dude.
Okay. Brock seems really cool. Let's talk about this, though, Sean.
Okay.
This is what I was having so much trouble not spoiling for you last time.
Yes.
When we were talking about this. You can go back and listen to it in my voice when I want to talk about these scenes. Is Atreus gets sick, Kratos realizes what he has to go to Helheim, and he realizes, fuck, I've got to go back to my past or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
And you go get the Blades of Chaos, and you have this whole new weapon set, and they're insane, and then you go to Helheim and you fight a giant. Like, all of that stuff, culminating in him telling Atreus this very brief story of his past, of like, I am from a far-off land. You know, I am a god, blah, 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 all that stuff. Chills, the way it brings in the God of War theme. I think what I said to you is, they will deliver on all those threads very well. Was I right?
Yeah, no. It was something of where the axe was so fully fleshed out as a weapon that I didn't think that you were going to get another weapon in the game.
No, I didn't either.
It felt like, no, you've got the axe, you've got your hand-to-hand, like, you've got all these fucking runic packs and all this shit. You know, the one hint was that my skill tree was mostly filled out at that point. So it's like, well, it seems like there's got to be something else you can dump XP into. But you can put XP into your, like, runic summons and stuff like that.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Like, maybe that's, like, the phase I'm moving into.
No matter what, you have a lot of extra XP in the game. So.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, when it, yeah, that scene happens of where you, I think Freya tells you that your axe is not going to work because it's a frost axe and you're going to Helheim and it's all frost stuff. It's like, you know, have you ever played Pokemon, buddy? Like, it's not going to work out the way you think it is. I was just like, oh, fuck, I need to get something else. It's like, we need some fire weapons. It's like, oh shit.
Yep.
It's like, okay. You know, and I think they do signal it pretty well. Like, I like, you know, particularly, like, at the beginning of the game where the bandages he has wrapped around his wrists, like, almost come loose. And so it's like, they do a little bit early on to kind of, like, signal that the Blades of Chaos were a thing, like, for people who, like, maybe forgot or and stuff like that. Yeah, when he has to go back to his house... And then, and when he has, like, that vision of Athena on the way, and, like, the fact
that... Oh, that whole boat ride down with the, like, the colored, like, sky and
everything. Yeah, because that's right after you've killed one of Thor's sons, so, like, Thor is going crazy, and, like, there's these maelstroms and lightning flashing everywhere, and Athena appears on the boat, and then when you go home, you find the Blades of Chaos, you pick them up, and then Athena, like, appears in the doorway and says, "You will always be a monster." It's like, I know, I'm your monster. Yeah, and then you step outside, put the fucking chains on, and it's like, oh shit. You have to fight all the Hellreavers that pop up. And yeah, the way they realize the Blades of Chaos in this combat system and, like, engine and the, like, tight in third person stuff is so fucking awesome. As someone who, like, really enjoyed the combat in those old games, the way that they, like, maintain the feel of what the Blades of Chaos felt like, but, like, up it, you know, to like modern standards, and the sound effects on the fucking chains, and just how fast and dangerous you feel compared to the, like, I still prefer using the axe for most combat stuff because I think it's really fun to use. But the axe is, like, big and heavy and lumbering, and it's like when you get these Blades of Chaos that can just swipe through, like, five enemies in one blow, it's a really effective sequence.
Well, and it immediately, like, reinvigorates the combat of the game, because you realize, like, as good as the combat was up to now, you ain't seen nothing yet.
Yeah.
Because what they're going to start doing is giving you, like, enemy types and, like, enemy loadouts and whatnot that require both weapons, that you're going to have to switch between them. Some scenarios, this is especially true in all the challenge stuff you get to do at the end in Niflheim and in Muspelheim,
yeah,
is you have a lot of scenarios where, like, okay, this is going to be better for this, but then I need to get close in, the axe isn't going to be, or, yeah, the Blades of Chaos are going to be better for close in. If I'm far off, I'm going to use my axe. If it's this, I'm going to need fire. If it's this, I want ice. And just, yeah, I probably leaned on the axe more too, but just the ability to be able to shift between these two very different but extremely complementary combat types was, I think, something that really made the combat in the last half of this game sing even more than it did in the first. Yeah.
And then also, I love that you have, like, a whole another set of runic attacks, yep, to find for the Blades of Chaos. And a lot of those are references to, or, like, incorporations of some of his moves from the previous games, which is really fucking cool.
I recognize the one where he, like, my favorite one was you, like, light all these fires under people, and he, like, does a thing where he makes an X with them,
yeah,
and then rips up and all the fire comes. I know that's from those games.
Yeah, and like, if you hold down your heavy attack, he does this, like, spin and knocks him into the air. Yeah, and... although I think my favorite thing to do with the Blades of Chaos is the, like, throw where you, like, stab it into people and you get that upgrade. Yeah, you can either pull them back, or if you hold it down with the upgrade, you, like, whip the chain and this, like, fireball shoots down the chain and blows them up. It's fucking awesome. Like,
it's so good. I love, there's the little floating guys you start meeting.
Yeah, the nightmares.
The nightmares, and you can take them, whip them in, and then throw them at another enemy. I love all of that.
Yeah, that's a great sequence, both in terms of, like, the drama of the story. Like, that's one instance where, like, the gameplay stuff and the story, like, 100% intersect. It is some good fan service for people who enjoy the old God of War games of, like, oh, fuck. You really do. Like, Kratos really knows how to use these things.
Yep. No, it's awesome. And I just... the whole sequence where he's, like, having to wrap the chains around his arms again and everything. There's real weight to it that, again, then is mirrored in the gameplay because you live it. You experience it. It becomes an integral part of the game. It's fascinating. It's so well done.
And, like, the very grounded, tight-in perspective of this game also just makes the Blades of Chaos feel so gnarly. Like, it's the kind of thing that I always kind of, in the old games, thought design-wise the Blades of Chaos looked kind of lame because they're, like, these, like, weird fat daggers. But in this game, like, they're just, like, kind of gnarled and, like, spiked, and you, like, wrap these big, heavy chains that, like, whistle through the air when you use it. And it's something that's, like, they're not normal weapons, you know, the axe. Like, he does, like, you know, obviously the axe has some magic powers, and Kratos does some gnarly shit with that axe. But at the end of the day, you know, you can both use it to chop off a guy's head and to, like, chop down a tree. Like, those Blades of Chaos are made for fucking killing shit, and they, like, really make that, you feel that. And it's like, they feel dirty to use to me.
I also love what they add to, like, the puzzle solving in the world. They just do a lot to, like, give this game a second push of energy for its second half, in that it ensures you're not going to be doing all the same stuff for the second half of the game, and there's going to be extra variety. And all the puzzles with, like, the winds of hell you get and have to whip around, there are some really fun ones with that that I love. Because, again, I platinum the game, so I got everything.
Uh-huh.
And there is some very fun stuff you do there. Let's finish, like, the last couple things about the story, and then maybe we'll see, like, some speculation about future games and any other gameplay stuff we want to talk about. So that last scene.
Yes.
Where we're back, we get to Jotunheim, and first you have the mural on the wall scene, where it's been Atreus' story as, like, prophesied or something.
Yeah.
I really liked that moment.
Yeah, me too.
There was the thing where Kratos sees something else on, like, the third wall of the mural. I didn't quite catch what he was looking at.
It's basically a Kratos, presumably dead, like, cradled in Atreus' arms with a serpent spilling out of Atreus' mouth, like, into Kratos. That either looks like either Atreus just killed Kratos, or Kratos just died and Atreus is doing something in response to it.
Interesting. So, yeah, I thought it was something like that, but I didn't quite know what to make of it, because it goes by kind of fast.
It is very ominous.
It's very ominous. You go up the mountain, that beautiful last scene we talked about, and there is also, of course, the scene where he takes off the wrappings. Yeah. I love that. And I think as the callback to it, the one of the first things he does in the game is, like, he gets those wrappings back on, and now he just lets them go. It's a really beautiful little moment, because he's also not doing it for anyone else. He just feels like, I need to do this here. I need to have these off. And I thought it was a beautiful little moment.
Yeah, and it's another, like, instance of some effective use of, like, symbolism of he's finally, like, you know, because what he's been doing for the whole game is, like, letting Atreus know about his past, and he's finally, like, you know, unsealing his scars, basically.
Yeah.
Like, both, like, literally and metaphorically, he's letting all that go. And it is that, like, the little movement he does of just, like, he kind of looses them and then, like, lets his arms go, and the winds just sort of, like, sweep them off of his arms, and you see the burns and the scars from the chains that, you know, like, was from when he was originally cursed for killing his family. So it is this, like, big culminating moment for the character.
Well, yeah, if the game is this series of unburdenings, as I said, there's this literal one at the end where he lets that part of his body show for the first time.
Yeah.
No, it's a great... That really feels kind of like the climax of the game in a lot of ways for Kratos. And then you have the final scene where they're on the mountain together, and they scatter. It's beautiful, sunset.
I like that they're both scattering ashes. Yep. Like,
he lets Atreus carry the bag the last bit of the way. That's because Atreus just asks over and over, and he's like, "No, boy, it's great." And then this is the one of the wildest things in the whole game is how smooth the transition is back into go explore.
Yeah.
You start walking back down the mountain and the credits play, but it never cuts again. Like, you can go back to your home and get a cut.
Yes.
But in this scenario, it's just you keep going. And I will say, the moment where they say he is Loki, that reminded me of, like, the scene in Skyfall where Miss Moneypenny... Or the scene in The Dark Knight Rises where it's like, you should use your real name, Robin. Something like that. It's not that bad.
Well,
I will say
at least for this, it's like setting up. It's not just like a like fan service drop. It's setting up where the games are going
to
go.
It is. I wish it wasn't in such close proximity to the emotional climax of the game. It did take me out of it a little bit of like appreciating this moment, and then we jump right back into something that, for the purposes of this game, can only exist as a sequel bait setup. Like, it has no like real like thematic heft behind it. Other than, you know, oh, I recognize Loki's name, and that will probably be important in a future game.
I mean, it is, like, looking at it from... This is something I want to, like, talk about more expansively, is, like, how they incorporate Norse mythology in general.
Yeah, yeah.
But, like, for this stuff, like, him being Loki is actually what, like, clicked all the mythology into place for me, because it was, like, And it was something where I couldn't believe I didn't notice that they had not mentioned Loki up to that point. Because it was like, there's just something, it was like, there's something missing. Like, there's something that's weird about this. And it was particularly like having Baldur there, where the Baldur myth is, like, the original version of the Baldur myth is that Baldur's mother, like, loves Baldur so much, but also has this prophecy that he's going to meet his doom. And so she has everything in the world promise not to harm Baldur, because it's mythology. Mythology is weird. That's how you go about these things. But the one thing she doesn't get is mistletoe, because it's small and seems harmless, but mistletoe is actually poisonous. But she kind of overlooks mistletoe. And Loki learns about that. And so then in what is a really weird sequence, all the, like, Baldur is like, hey guys, I'm totally immortal. And all the other gods are like, that's awesome. And Baldur's like, check it out. And like, they're all just like throwing shit at Baldur and like throwing axes and boulders. And they're just bouncing off of Baldur because he's totally immortal. So it's not quite what this game does of like, he's gripped with this intense personal dread. They kind of, you know, like sexy it up a bit for modern storytelling standards. But yeah, he's just like, I'm so perfect. And then Loki tricks one of the other gods and be like, hey, what if you hit him with this arrow, and it's an arrow made out of mistletoe, hits Baldur, and Baldur dies. And so for that, the other gods sentence Loki basically to be, this is probably my favorite myth is in Norse mythology, is Loki is chained to like the bed of the earth of like Midgard, and a serpent is dripping venom into his eyes, and Loki's wife has a bowl that she holds over his eyes and to collect the venom. But when the bowl gets full, she has to step away and dump it. And when she's dumping it, the venom drips into Loki's eyes and burns him. And so he writhes in pain, and that's what earthquakes are.
That's fucking great.
Which is a fucking great myth. But like, that's one of the more well-known...
How did we not get Tom Hiddleston doing that?
Maybe we'll get there. Who knows? Yeah. There's a, you know, Marvel movies can do whatever the fuck they want. But yeah, so like, that's one of the most well-known Norse myths. It's like, that's one of the ones that's dramatized in some form in Sandman and that kind of stuff. And so when they're doing the Baldur stuff, it's just like, there's something weird going on here. And when they say that Atreus is Loki, so much clicked into place for me of like, okay, that's why he's smart. That's why he has all this, like, the faculty for language. I assumed that he was like a new god and he was like the god of language. But it's like, no, if he's the god of like cunning and trickery and like he will be able to just like shapeshift and do all that stuff. Like, all of that makes so much sense to me. And then it also, what it does for me is it then, like, sets Kratos and Atreus onto this path of being directly opposed to the Aesir and the other gods. Because the Ragnarok is the Jotnar and the giants and all those versus the Aesir. And so when Mimir says, I think, like, after you kill Baldur, well, it seems like we're the monsters now. And like, at least in Freya's eyes, it's like, when it's revealed that he's Loki, it's like, no, you straight up are the villains of Ragnarok. Like, that's
right.
That's the role that you have been dealt in fate, is like, you are, like, because there's all this shit. Like, because Loki is the father of Jormungandr, the world serpent, which is maybe something you don't know. Like, he's also not the brother of Thor, so like, that's a Marvel movie thing, so forget about that. But he's the father of Jormungandr, he's the who kills Thor and is also killed in Ragnarok. He's the father of Fenrir, the wolf, which is what kills Odin in Ragnarok, and he's the father of Hel that rules over Helheim. So it's like, there's all these, like, it's this big move that they make to like signal where it's going, but I do also think it says something about where this game is of like, you are the villains in some ways. You are the monsters of mythology. Like, you are the ones that are opposed to the great shining beacons on the hill. Like,
yeah.
You are what comes up from behind and destroys all of that to make the world anew.
I think it's a really cool idea. I'm really excited, you know, hearing all the stuff of, like, what they're going to be able to do with it. My only thing was just kind of where it is in proximity a bigger core emotional thing, and that it just felt slightly distracting because it does feel like the big name drop thing. But yes, no, it suggests a lot, and like, the game is mythologically literate enough that obviously I don't think they're just dropping that name because, hey, that's the big god we had forgotten about. Yeah. And I agree what you said there, like, because I assume that either the next game or one after it is going to be called God of War Ragnarok, just because what else are they going to subtitle it?
Yeah, unless they just say, fuck it, God of War 2, here we go again.
The God, no, please, God no. God of War 2, no.
Hell on Earth.
I'd be okay with that.
Yeah.
If it's Hell, like H-E-L. Yes, no, yes.
Hell, Helheim on Midgard.
Oh, I'm on Midgard. But anyway, yeah, it's an exciting idea, and I like what you say about, like, they are the ones opposed to the gods. Because that actually, let's speculate a little bit about what God of War 2 Hell on Earth is going to be. Because that kind of feels like that would be an interesting journey for Kratos, of Kratos, you know, being like, I don't want to kill gods anymore. And fate being like, yeah, but you guys are the forces of Ragnarok. Yeah. Something like that. I think there's a lot of juicy stuff they could do there beyond just cool mythology stuff.
Yeah. Well, like, what some stuff they do is, like, they're very, like, knowing that they're going to be sequels, it was smart that they don't go to all the realms in this game.
Yeah.
So it's like, you very specifically don't go to Asgard, you don't go to Vanaheim, and you don't go to Svartalfheim. Fuck you, that's one of the ones that I'm not very good on pronouncing. But yeah, so there's, like, good room to go with those. I also hope that, like, Muspelheim and Niflheim are explored in more of, like, a story sense in a future game, because I think it'd be...
Muspelheim, like, looks so cool.
Yeah. Because that's also where Surtur, the giant fire demon, like, troll is.
Yes.
That's, like, you might know from the beginning of Thor Ragnarok. And so it's like, you have to meet Surtur. He's not just, like, giant swords in the ground. Like, I want to fucking see that dude.
Yes.
Yeah, but, yeah, for, in terms of, like, story speculation, for me, like, the question is, at what point does Atreus become the main playable character? Like,
that's a good,
like, I feel like that has got to be the direction you go in. And for me, I, like... this is, like, wild speculation, and there would be very good reasons not to do this. I do think it'd be kind of fucking awesome if, like, Kratos is one of the bosses of the game. That, like, once you switch over... Because it's, like, Kratos, like, you could come up with so many reasons to have Atreus, like, ultimately go against Kratos.
Yeah.
It's, like, that would be so fucking awesome if that's... Because there's all the shit you have to deal with, like... Is Atreus then going to be the person, like, tied to the rock with fucking serpent venom dripping in his eyes for 100 years, you know? Like, I feel like they have to address that component of the myth, because that's also really well known. Like, what do you do with that kind of stuff is something I'm interested in.
I do wonder, like, there's a point where you could go too far afield with the mythology stuff and lose some of the emotional character-based core, but I think there's a lot of possibilities. Some kind of Atreus-Kratos conflict at some point would, as you say, be very interesting. They could even fucking Metal Gear Solid 2 this bitch at some point and have you start as Kratos and he gets killed or wounded or something, and then you're Atreus for most of the game. That would be very interesting. I don't think the Metal Gear Solid 2 twist could work in our modern environment where you have to show off games for 3 years before you release them, but, you know.
Oh, I thought you were saying that they couldn't just, like, have, like, Odin or somebody just, like, rant at you for 30 minutes at the end of the game before the last boss fight, like they do in Metal Gear Solid 2.
No, I think, you know, I think if the Death Stranding thing falls through, I think Hideo Kojima should write the next God of War.
Fuck it, I would be interested to see what the fuck he'd come up with.
It would not be good.
No.
But anyway, yeah, I do think, like, what they're going to do with Atreus is super interesting. Like, when does the next game pick up?
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't think you want to do another one where he's, like, a little kid.
No.
And it's the same dynamic. I think you want to pick up enough years in the future that things have changed. You probably change his voice actor, you know, kind of like a Star Wars Episode 1 to Episode 2 sort of thing.
Yeah.
But I am super curious, like, at some point, like, I think this God of War is very much Kratos' story with Atreus in it.
Yeah.
I think it is going to have to transition to it's Atreus' story with Kratos in it, right? And that is going to be interesting, because there has not been a God of War game, to my knowledge at least, where Kratos is not the playable character, right?
No.
And at some point, that's going to... It seems like they're setting themselves up for that. And I guess that's one of the most fascinating things, is that they've started this kind of new God of War franchise, and it does not feel like in any way they are doing this to rest on their laurels and do anything easy. It feels like the whole idea is that this is, like, almost effectively a new series with a lot of roots from these other games.
Yeah. Like, I would honestly be surprised if Kratos was not dead by the end of this, like, cycle of games.
Right.
I don't see how he survives too much longer. You know, maybe he lives through the next game. It's like, he has to die at some point.
Yes. This does not feel like the kind of game where you get a nice Uncharted 4 ending where he goes and lives on a beach with his wife.
And he makes a third family.
Yes.
Like, it's not worked out super great for me so far. This one, third time, is going to be the charm.
On the flip side, I do wonder if Naughty Dog will be inspired by God of War to do an Uncharted 6, where Nathan Drake and his daughter, it's old Nathan and his daughter is learning about, Dad, you killed so many people. I know they wanted the treasure.
You have to be better than me, girl.
You could be pretty good.
Yeah.
But anyway, you have Christopher Judge voice Nathan Drake now, too.
Yeah,
he replaces,
like,
Nolan,
you know,
North.
Yeah, it's fine. We recast Kratos. We can recast... Yeah.
Nathan Drake, no. But yes, it's... I do think God of War, I think this is one of those games that I imagine a lot of the industry is looking at jealously. What can we take from this technologically, narratively? That one-shot thing was really cool, you know? I wonder if this is almost also... because this game so clearly mixes so many different types of gameplay. I really do wonder if future Naughty Dog games are going to have some element of this too. Because, like, Uncharted 5, or The Lost Legacy, whatever you want to call it, has some of that, like, that big open world section, you know? And it does feel like Naughty Dog could be gearing up maybe with Last of Us 2 or something in the future to kind of mix their traditional linearity with something a little more open. And I wonder if that would wind up feeling a little like a God of War or something. There's just... It's a really good game.
It's a really fucking good game. Yeah. Also, on my future prediction stuff, one other element that this game does that I think is really interesting is in that middle bit when you go to Tyr's Temple, which is also, that's like the most God of War part of this God of War game, is when it's like giant spinning blades on the ceiling.
I like that part a lot.
It's, yeah, like that's very God of War. I thought it was a nice nod, because also like Tyr is the god, like the Norse God of War, that there's, it's like, and I like the way that Tyr is sort of present in some ways in the game, but like he's obviously either dead or gone, he's been missing forever, and a lot of like the stuff that he did and has left behind sort of shapes what the Kratos and Atreus' journey, including that Tyr has visited other places, like not just other realms, because the realm means something very specific in this sense. He's been to Greece, he has that urn that has like an image of Kratos on it, but he's also, they like, I feel like they kind of like set these signposts, or like do this like Babe Ruth like point to the stands thing where they put in some Egyptian shit and they put in some Japanese shit, and it's like we can go to the pharaohs, we can go to like Shinto, like we like, they're like, there's fucking, if we want to, God of War can be so much shit. And I like that they just sort of like, it's the only part of the game other than the fact that like Kratos exists in this world that sort of directly acknowledges that there are these competing other mythologies that are coexisting in some way. And that is one of the most enticing ideas about this entire game to me, that they kind of like flirt around, is the idea that there's just this fucking Greek God of War is just walking around in Norse mythology, and a lot of like the Norse people like kind of don't entirely know what to do with that information. It's like, this is fucking crazy, and like some of us kind of know, have heard legends of you, and like others, like, I don't know who the fuck this guy is. And so the idea of visiting other mythologies like that is so tantalizing to me.
And it's a weird thing to think about, though, because it feels like you've set up more than enough in this one that you could easily do your whole trilogy never leaving Norse mythology.
Oh, for sure.
And that if you were to do the same kind of dedicated thing where at the end of every cycle Kratos leaves for another mythology, it would be, you know, a decade plus before we got to Egypt or something.
Yeah.
But then you wonder, is maybe some of the plan to mix some of these things in with the Norse stuff? Like, will the next God of War look substantially different than what this one did? Like, it's... there are a lot of possibilities. As much as they lay down, it's also hard to imagine what exactly the next one is, you know?
Mm-hmm.
There definitely will be one. This game sold like fucking hotcakes.
Yeah. You know, and they put in that little, like, extra bit at the end when you go back to home, and Thor shows up like a fucking, like, lightning gunslinger.
Yeah.
Like, slips his coat back and, like gets his hammer ready.
Yeah, That was funny, but yes. I'm excited to see where they go next.
Yeah.
It's a hell of a thing. It's a weird thing where this is technically one of the oldest PlayStation IPs.
Yeah, still going for sure, yeah.
But it also feels like they successfully relaunched the IP, you know? Like, this is a new IP, still called God of War. Honestly, this feels to me like something more than anyone else in the industry Microsoft needs to pay attention to. This is how you do Gears of War or Halo in 2018. I think there is no more story to tell with Gears of War as they did it, but I do think it's possible that you could take a lot of those fundamentals and try something new with it.
Yeah.
I think the Halo story ran as hard into the ground as a story possibly can in Halo 5, which is not a good video game. And I think I would be much more interested, and I mean, I've thought this since like Halo Reach, like since Bungie was done with the series, of like, the thing to do is not to keep telling Master Chief's story. It's Halo is this giant, you know, big open sci-fi universe. You could tell any story you want, and then you can make your own game out of it. That's what to do. Like, I joked about it last time, but probably the healthiest thing for the Halo brand would be in 2020 to have a game just called Halo and let it be its own thing. Because that's the other thing is that, you know, if this were called God of War 8, you know, and was clearly another Greek set sequel or prequel or whatever, it would sell like a fifth as much because lot of people would feel alienated and they wouldn't get into it. And it would have
and
just
even
been going...
the people that, like me, that like the old God of War games, like, I didn't play God of War Ascension. I didn't play the PSP games because at some point, like, those three God of War games are pretty fucking similar in terms of gameplay stuff. And, like, God of War 3's story kind of ends on a fart and it's like, okay, like, you know, I'm kind of done with this stuff. That, yeah, if they had shown up with a God of War 4 or whatever the fuck you would have called it, and it was Kratos goes and, like, fights... fucking Pan, like whoever, like Dionysus, like whoever the fuck is left after the end of God of War 3, this pretty slip pickings. But it's like he goes and fights some other like Greek, or maybe like they like cheat and say like, oh, what if like the Roman gods, and now he's fighting Jupiter instead of Zeus.
He fights Cupid. It's a love story. Cupid shoots him with an arrow.
Man, Kratos has been fighting with Cupid his whole life. This is a totally different way. But yeah, like instead of doing that, they do like what is... one of the most radical reinventions of a franchise I've ever seen.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
It's like Resident Evil 4 or fucking, like... I mean, it's beyond even something that I think, like, in some ways Ocarina of Time does. Because while Ocarina of Time shifts into three dimensions, it keeps the gameplay structures and mechanics of Link.
Or like a Metroid Prime or something. Like, it's in that vein, but Metroid Prime is still very recognizably a Metroid game. At heart, this is... arguably not in a lot of ways, or its heart is in a different, more mature place. But yeah, like there is just an obvious law of diminishing returns for most franchises that you let run too long, you know. And I think sadly those are the only kinds of franchises Microsoft has left. You know, one of them is kind of immune to that. If it's Forza, you know, racing games, people will always play. That doesn't matter.
Yeah, but there's like, not like this story that they're like getting tired of with Forza.
But you know, Halo. Is still big. It's probably always going to sell decently, but if you wanted to inject new life into it, I think it's time to let go of the past. And I think this is just a big signal to a lot of, particularly Western franchises like that, that have been going forever and have no real capital left anymore.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, fuck, Assassin's Creed needs something like this, weirdly, of like, I mean, it's not as long running a series, but, you know, something to just, and I think Origins was like, 50-50 this,
sure,
to kind of like really rethink how we do something like this. But it's interesting. And it's so cool that Sony was like, yeah, spend 5 years and $2 billion or however much it looks like it cost that much, you know, of figuring this out. And clearly it was worth it because people like it. It sold a lot. It's, you know, I bought a fucking PS4 Pro to play it.
There you go, yeah.
I mean, there were other reasons, but like, yeah, it's a cool thing.
Yeah. I mean, like, think about that Halo stuff. It is the kind of thing that felt like Halo 3 ended with, like, this possibility to do what this God of War did of, like no, like, God of War 3 ends with Kratos, like, maybe dead, but has, like, kind of, like, slunk off after murdering the entire Greek pantheon. There's, like, a little bit of a teaser, like, he might actually be alive. And they, like, took it at this, like, faith, and it's, like... okay, that's an opportunity to completely change the status quo, change everything about both the story and the game. And Halo 3 has that ending of, like, the Covenant War is done. Like, Master Chief is fuck who knows where. Like, he's just landed on some crazy planet in some other corner of the galaxy. And Halo 4 starts, and what do you immediately encounter? Covenant.
Right.
It's like, and I like the Halo 4 just fine, but it is, like, a disappointing thing to be like, well, we have... like, you know, the Prometheans are a new enemy race instead of having the Flood, which was the older other, like, second enemy race. It's like, but we still have our core, like, elite grunt, jackal, hunter. Like, we have, like, assault rifles and battle rifles and DMRs and magnums and all that. Like, all of it is still Halo, 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 Halo with, like, a little bit of extra new stuff on top.
Yeah.
I agree with you that it's like, you need to, at some point, shake the entire foundation of the thing. Unfortunately, Halo is, like, in this, like, spot where it feels kind of impossible to do that because it would be weird for, like, you'd make Halo 4, Halo 5, and then Halo 6 is God of War, right?
Right. Yeah, I don't... I mean, Halo's hard to speculate on because we know nothing about what they're working on. It's a weird thing. Other than mild intimations that there might be a Halo Reach remaster, but other than that, we have no clue. But yeah, it's... I think this game is one of the special games of this generation. Not my favorite, but, like... In the echelon at the top.
Yeah, I think it, like, some of the stuff it does with, like, the smoothness of its design, the way it, like, so heavily incorporates every aspect of it into the whole being yep. of the game, in terms of like loading screens, in terms of the blacksmiths, in terms of like the way that the game ends in this way that is incredibly inviting to like engaging with the extra material of the game, as opposed to, I feel like, is typical for these games. Like the hardest I felt on this one, the game recently, was Breath of the Wild, where it's like if you beat Ganon in that game, it's like you hit credits and then it's load your last save from before you beat Ganon and do the other stuff. Which is like, to me, feels like now it's like everything else is fake because it's like I already finished the story. Everything else is like weird blah stuff. Whereas like in God of War, no, like you finish the game and you get this like smooth sort of like incorporated credit sequence, and it's immediately like you want to go fight the Valkyries, you want to go to Muspelheim and do that shit. Like you can go do whatever you want, and it still feels like it's part of the story.
And just the sense of like life goes on is also just a really nice, powerful thing there, because the Breath of the Wild thing, that's just been the standard in video games forever, is that's how any kind of game with an ongoing story does it at the end. Like, all the Zelda games do that. A lot of RPGs do that. A lot of, Mario 64, you don't even get to save at the end or something. You just have to, like, roll it back, and you're never going to have, like, an end save file or something. Like, that's just an old video game thing. And it does feel like gradually we're finding a way to move past that. Like, this, Witcher 3 does it well. Obviously, you know, it's a cool thing.
Yes. And the last thing I want to say about this game, like on all those notes, is because we kind of talked over it a little bit, was the sequence in the middle, like how you get to Helheim for the second time, is one of the most, like from a technical perspective, one of the most insane things I've ever seen in a video game.
I don't know how they did it.
You go from the top of that fucking mountain to like down to Tyr's temple, through the portal into Helheim in one unbroken sequence with no fucking loading screens, that you are playing for like half of it on that dragon. And like, obviously, like when you're in the fog on the dragon, that's where it's doing the loading. Like, I can kind of tell where the cracks are a little bit, but it's still fucking, I've never seen a game do that. Like, that's madness, you know?
It is.
It's like, that feels like that's going to be next year's GDC. There's going to be one of, like, the like technical programmers on God of War is going to give an hour-long presentation about how the fuck did this work.
Oh, I think at next year's GDC, everyone's going to want to know, for just lots of God of War, how the fuck does this work. Because it is, like, maybe the most technically accomplished game I've ever seen.
Yeah. There's, like, games are, usually you can see the seams so hard in video games when you've played enough of them.
Yeah.
And God of War is a game that I have difficulty seeing the seams in a lot. And
oh yeah, it's,
that's really impressive to me.
Well, it's like when you see a movie that uses like a one-shot thing, like Birdman from a couple of years ago. And if you're film literate enough, like you can tell where they're disguising cuts and whatnot. But it's still super impressive to think about like how they did it. With God of War, there's the extra layer of like there are literal technical like, Is there the power to do this on the hardware you're doing it on?
Yeah, like how the fuck are you moving, like streaming this data to the hard drive in such a way that you can transition between these two things that like usually being in Tyr's Temple and being in Helheim, there's like a, like 30 seconds of standing around in that room that needs to happen before you get there. And it's like, how the fuck did you get around that?
It's a hell of a game. So God of War, very good. I imagine we'll revisit it near the end of the year on our year-end podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Who knows?
I would be very surprised if there were 10 games that came out this year better than God of War. Like, I think it's probably my number one so far.
Yeah, I would still put Celeste above it. And I still haven't finished Digimon Story, Cyber Sleuth Hacker's Memory.
Yeah.
But, you know me, and I love my Digimon.
Yes.
But we'll see. It's been a good year. We've still got a lot to go, you know. I'm intimidated already by September. You know. And that's before Red Dead 2.
Yes, one day we will know what Red Dead 2 is.
Yes, we will. Maybe not this week, maybe not next week, but someday.
Yeah. Well, until that time, Jonathan, I have a lot of Norse poems that I need to catch up on, so I need to get to that.